Okay, good morning. I'll call to order the meeting of the Legislative Commission of Pensions and Retirement for Wednesday, August 12, 2009. We do not yet have a quorum present. We are meeting in the City Council Chambers of the Bemidji City Hall today for our regularly scheduled meeting. We'll be following our normal procedures here, but obviously because we are in a different location and have some a number of people who normally are not familiar with the Pension Commission meeting will be explaining as we what we do as we go along. My name is Don Betzel. I'm a state senator, and I chair the Pensions Commission. Just for your information, I represent an area, the northern Minneapolis suburban area. I live in Fridley. I represent part of Moundsview, Spring Lake Park, and Blaine. I'll also ask the commission members and the staff to identify themselves, too, so you know who they are. We'll start with the House. Representative Kahn?
Yes, I'm Representative Phyllis Kahn. I've been a member of the Pension Commission on and off for many years, and my district is in Minneapolis, right around the university. It's mainly a University of Minnesota district.
I'm Representative Michael Nelson. I represent Brooklyn Park, and which is District 46A, and I've been on the Pension Commission 4 years, 6 years. I don't remember this. It's been in a couple of years.
And I should also note we also commission members, Representative Steve Smith and Representative Paul Thiessen, sent their regrets that they could not make it here today. We are expecting Representative Mary Murphy from Hermantown. She's the vice chair of the commission. We have professional staff as well, too. I'll get the senators then. Professional staff.
I'm Larry Martin. I'm the executive director of the Legislative Commission, and I live in Richfield.
I'm Ed Burek. I'm the deputy director, and I live in Coon Rapids.
My name is Lisa Dieslin. I'm the commission assistant, and I live in Maplewood, Minnesota.
We have Senate members, too. Now, just so you know why I get to chair it as opposed to others, the gavel passes back and forth. Every 2 years, the House of Representatives chairs the commission, and the Senate chairs it. It's the Senate's turn, and so my Senate colleagues introduce themselves. Senator Pappas.
Senator Sandy Pappas. I represent about a quarter of the city of St. Paul, downtown and the Capitol, and neighborhoods to the west, south, and north.
I'm Senator Ann Lynch. I represent the Rochester area and surrounding communities of Plainview, Dover, Eota, Elgin, Stuartville,
and
Chatfield.
Our host for this meeting, Senator Murphy, Sarah Olson. Sarah Olson asked to have the meeting up here because she indicated that there's a number of retirees up here. There's a number of issues that felt were important. So Senator Olson, thank you for having us, and would you like to make some comments?
Sure. Hopefully all of you here know me. I'm Senator Mary Olson. I'm the senator representing this district. And I'd first of all like to extend a very heartfelt thank you to Senator Betzold and the rest of the legislators who all agreed to make the trip up here, as well as staff who worked to put this together. I know that there are a lot of government employees, retired government employees, as well as active employees living in this area who often contact me about pension issues. Because of, I think, the nature of our district, we have a disproportionate share of those kinds of retirees living in our area. And I know it's also a long way to St. Paul. Senator Lynch just reminded me that it's an awful long drive up here. So I was hoping that we would have an opportunity during the interim to have an out-state meeting up in this area, just make it a little bit easier for people to come, experience a Pensions Commission meeting, perhaps ask some questions or give some input. And there's Senator Betzel is graciously going to be allowing time for that at the end of our meeting. I also want to say, on the record, a special thank you to Senator Betzold's wife. She had her birthday a couple days ago and graciously agreed to start their trip up here then. And then they've had their 20th wedding anniversary while they've been up here staying at Rutgers. So she really went a long way out of her way to accommodate the legislature, and we certainly all appreciate that. I'd also like to thank the City of Bemidji. They've been very gracious in offering us this space and this and for other meetings, too. It's really appreciated. So thank you all. And then a final thanks to all of you. I recognize some faces from down at the Capitol, but hopefully also, you know, people have locally brought their concerns and questions here. And this is an issue a responsibility that everyone here on the commission takes extremely seriously. We know that this, you know, people's retirement and the security of their retirement is one of the most important things in people's lives. And so that's a large responsibility you've given us, and we very much appreciate your input. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just again, we're going to be following the normal procedures that we have. There is an agenda in the back, as well as the written materials that have been provided to the commission staff. You're all welcome to take a copy of the materials if you wish. We, just as we do with any legislative meeting, we are recording what we are doing here, so that in the future, if people want to listen to what we said, they have an opportunity to do so, which also means that if anybody here wishes to testify and bring things to our attention, you will need to go to the podium and speak into the microphone. We might be able to hear you if you're standing in the back and just stand up, but the microphone can't hear you. So in order to make sure that we have a complete record, if anybody does wish to address the commission, we need to have you go to the podium. Also, just you should be aware that we're not passing any laws today. We can't. The legislature is not in session. It's not in session until next February, and the Pension Commission does not pass laws. What we do is we have hearings, we consider issues, and then next year in the legislative session, we will put together a pensions bill, which will travel separately through the House of Representatives and in the Minnesota Senate. And then at some point, we will have a final bill that we will submit to the governor. We obviously take the information that you provide to us very seriously, and so it ultimately may affect some of the issues and decisions that we make later on. But you're not going to see any laws passed today because that's, you know, that isn't how the process works. I'll also be remiss in mentioning Senator Julie Rosen from Fairmont also sends her regrets because she's a member of the Pension Commission and could not make it here today, too. We do have, besides the Pension Commission, I see there's a number of representatives from some of the major pension organizations and some of the labor organizations who are here today. I've seen representatives of PERA, MSRS, TRA, St. Paul Teachers, AFSCME. There may be others here. So to the extent that you may have questions for them, that they are in a better position to answer, we certainly invite their expertise as well, too. Just so you get an idea of what we're going to be doing here today, as I said, we do have an agenda, and we'll be going through it. We'll be taking a break at some point where it seems logical so that people can stretch, maybe get a quick snack or something. We will go no longer than 3 p.m. I realize that there may be some people who want to talk and so forth. We'll do the best we can, but by 3 p.m. we do have to be shutting down, so just you're aware of our agenda here, too. And I also want to thank the Bemidji City Hall for allowing us to use these chambers. If you do wish to testify and bring anything to our attention, there is a sign-up sheet in the back of the chambers here. And if you could just sign your name on that, at, when it gets to that point of public testimony, I'll look it over and kind of group, make sure that we've got the grouping so that we can have the topics in some logical sequence. If you're planning on testifying, we welcome that. Just make it succinct and brief to the point and not be repetitive. We usually try to follow those procedures in our hearings. Any comments or questions from the members before we get started here? Now, one of the things we do in the Pension Commission is a little bit different from other legislative hearings, either in the House or the Senate, is normally we have bills presented. The author presents the bill. The members ask questions of it. We have a professional staff that you've already met, and they, when we have issues, whether they're bills or proposals before the Pension Commission, they write up a proposal before us, and that kind of lays out the issues. And so what we usually do is start off having a presentation by our professional staff explaining what the issue is. Then we have questions or comments from the commission members, and then we open it up to the public or other people who want to discuss that issue to us. So, actually, we don't have quorum yet. We have an administrative quorum, right? We have administrative quorum. So, actually, the first item on our agenda is approval of the prior commission minutes, and that is the minutes of July 8th, 2009. So, Representative Kahn moves adoption minutes. So discussion of that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The second item on our agenda is a bill that was introduced in the past legislative session. It's Senate File 1601 by Senator Mary Olson, and House File 1793 by Representative Nelson. This would be adding a second retired member to the Board of the Trustees of TRA. And as I say, we do have a write-up here, so and it appears that this would be Mr. Burek's topic. So, Mr. Burek, could you give us a description of what the bill is and what the issues are?
Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 1601, House File 1793 would expand the Board of Trustees of the Teachers Retirement Association, the TRA Board, from the current 8 members to 9 members by the addition of a second retired board member position. TRA's board currently has 8 members. 3 of the members are appointed by the governor, and the 3 appointees are the Commissioner of Finance, the Commissioner of Education, and a representative of the Minnesota School Boards Association. Those appointed members are in a position to represent the fiscal interests and the overall policy interests of the state. In addition to those appointed members, there are 5 elected members. In addition to those 3 appointed members, there are 5 elected members. 4 of the elected members represent the active members of TRA, and they are elected by the active membership of TRA. And currently there is 1 retired position on the board, which represents the retirees and is elected by the retirees. The policy issues that are raised by this bill is, first of all, the broad question of whether pension boards are needed or whether the functions of these boards and retirement associations could instead be moved into a state department. The function of these boards is basically to make sure that the retirement associations operate according to law. They review procedures to make sure they're consistent with law. They review the budget, and they do review disability claims. But there is an issue of whether that could simply be moved into a state agency or state department, given this general function of making sure that the organization is operated according to law, is the same general charge that is given to any state-level agency. The second issue is the justification or lack of justification for the different board structures that we currently find among our retirement plans. All these retirement boards are performing an identical function, and yet they differ considerably in size and composition. In terms of size, when you look at the teacher boards, teacher plan boards, and also the boards of the Public Employees Retirement Association, the Minnesota State Retirement Association, and the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund, when you look at those boards, you see that they vary in size from 7 members to 11 members. There's no clear rationale for the differences in size. I also note that some of those boards have no state representation on them, although there is a considerable state financial interest in those boards, in particular, the MRF board, the MRF Association has no state representation, but they've received a considerable amount of state aid. And also the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund and the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund are currently also receiving direct state aid, but have no state representative on those boards. The third issue I noticed, the implications of adding an additional seat rather than simply replacing an additional active member. One implication of that is that it may help avoid potential conflict between the active members of the fund and the retired members of the fund, because we're not replacing one with another. But by adding an additional seat, the appointed members have a lower overall percentage of the membership because you've added an additional elected member. So the interests of the state and from a policy standpoint and from a fiscal standpoint don't have quite as much clout when you start extending the board. Another point I would note is that adding an additional receipt reserved for retirees may encourage similar requests by other interest groups. Commission members may recall that, I believe it was 2 years ago, there was a bill that would have added an additional position to TRA's board that would be reserved for a member of the Minnesota Board of State Administrators. The commission did hear the bill, but the commission decided to not take action on that. The commission may wish to consider that adding seats may lead to additional requests, and it may make it harder to say no to these additional groups. Finally, I would note that there are two amendments for consideration. The first one is a technical amendment. The bill was drafted assuming that it would be acted upon during the 2009 session. That did not occur, so a technical amendment would be needed to simply revise some dates regarding when this new retiree position would be elected and first take office. The second alternative, the 2A amendment, is an alternative to the current bill. And what that amendment would do is it would revise the bill so that rather than adding a position, it would reduce the active member positions on the board by one and replace that with a retiree position. There is a table in the memo that you may wish to look at, and that's on page 2 of the memo. And in that table, what I did was I noted how the representation in percentage terms has changed over time, starting in 1998 through the most current date, 2008, for which we had data. If you take the active members on the board and the retired members on the board, since there are four active members and only one retired member, the active board members relative to the, or the retired board members relative to the active board members are 25% throughout, since that has not been changed. If you look at the actual membership of the association, that would be the column one over to the left. In 1998, 39% of the total membership was retirees, and that has grown over time to the current date of 2008 to grow to 61%. So the retirees are increasing relative to the active members, and that might be an argument for increasing the positions reserved on the board for retirees. Those comments, I turn back to the commission.
Okay. It's come to our attention, apparently the mics are not turned on. City staff has been trying to work on it. They've been kind of in and out, so I'm not quite sure. We had hoped that they would have been on by now, but we'll do the best we can to keep talking loud until we get that rectified. So that's been the presentation, and we do have the two authors here on the commission, so either Senator Olson or Representative Nelson, do you have any comments about the bill before we get into discussion on the merits? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think...
Well... Andy Williams. Can't get used to losing you.
A little background music.
Yeah.
Can everyone hear us now? I think maybe the mics are on or still not on. Okay. Well, I'll try and speak loudly then. I was asked, Representative Nelson and I were asked on behalf of the retirees to bring this matter to the attention of the board. It wasn't urgent last session because there wasn't going to be an election coming up until we would have a chance to have one more legislative session. But I think the reasons for the request are set out very well in Mr. Burek's analysis. I guess the only thing maybe I would spend a little bit more time pointing out is that because of the legislative action that was taken that resulted in the merger of the post
fund with the active fund. Apparently that caused a lot of the, or that's partly responsible for the increased percentage of retiree versus active members, as well as the fact that I think, you know, the something we've spent a lot of time talking about legislation is just that we've already experienced and are likely to continue to experience a substantial increase in the number of people in that age group of people who are going to be retiring. And so that was the reason for the request that the membership, it still won't actually numerically reflect anything close to the breakdown of active versus retired members, but it would put a little bit more emphasis on the retirees in order to reflect the substantial number of people who are retired. And then the other thing, in terms of the balance of power, that certainly was not something I'd ever thought about that was raised in the memo, the issue of appointed versus elected members. But the counter to that I think a person might raise is simply the fact that these issues do have to eventually come before the legislature if we're going to have any change in the law. And so certainly anything that would be a change of the law would have ultimately go through the legislative process.
Olson, did you have any comments?
Senator Olson basically summed them up, but it's the, again, it was brought to me, was asked to bring it forward. I signed on to it to bring it forward. And for the discussion purposes, I think if we're going to go forward with this, we do need to do the technical amendment to change the date.
Right.
But again, I think the 33 versus 37%, it's still roughly a third, you know, of the membership is the appointed people. And again, as stated, the legislature has to act on it if there's any changes, because we ultimately set the rates and set that so that we have to bring it, has to come before us anyway. So I don't see that big of a difference between 37 and 33%, and it would give more input from retirees to their pensions.
As was noted, the bill was drafted with an effective date that's already, or the implementation date's already passed. But we don't have a full quorum yet, because it would take 3 members of the House, 3 members of the Senate. We don't have 3 members of the House here, so we're not able to adopt an amendment right now to put the bill in the shape that we would like to proceed. But if Representative Murphy comes in, that motion would certainly be in order to do that. I will be interested in hearing from not only TRA, but also the other pension funds, because it may, even though it's not directly affecting them, it could. So if they have any thoughts on it. But before we do that, do any of the members have any questions about the memo, about the issue we have before us? If not, do we have a representative from TRA who can speak to the issue? Ms. Hacking? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Laurie Hacking with...
And you'll need to speak up so that everybody can hear you, too. So.
Is the mic working now? Or no?
No. No.
Okay, sorry. I'm with the Teachers Retirement Association, Executive Director. Our board has looked at this proposal and has decided to basically remain neutral with respect to it. We certainly understand there are some pluses to it and minuses, but our board really did not feel like it wanted to take a position on the proposal. I think our board members, during the discussion, expressed a very strong opinion that when they serve on the board, regardless of whether they're elected by retirees, actives, or appointed by the finance department or Department of Education, they really owe a fiduciary duty to all members of the fund, as well as the state and the taxpayers. And that fiduciary law and responsibility is outlined very clearly in 356. So that's the TRA's position. We just have one advice. If you do go forward with the bill and the technical amendment, we would prefer that you have it effective in an odd number year, because that is when our elections are held. That we just had one in 2009. Our next one will be in 2011 and then 2013. The retiree election is actually in 2013. So just for kind of economies of scale and having things in sync, we would prefer it to be in an odd number here.
So the 1A amendment doesn't quite work if it were to be adopted. You need to suggest a change there?
Yes, to an odd number year. 2011 or 2013, and I think it just makes sense then to just have a four-year term. There'd be no need for a transition.
Okay, well, maybe we can see if that could be done on the informally here while we're still concerned. I have a bit of concern. Well, first, I have a couple of concerns here. First of all, the Sarah Olson mentioned the fact that, you know, we've merged the active fund with the post fund, and that's true, but the TRA board actually oversaw both of them, so the merging, I don't imagine, you know, did it really affect the day-to-day operations or decisions made by TRA as opposed to the retirees from before when they were separated as opposed to now? Has that those dynamics changed at all with the merger?
Not explicitly. You're correct. The board is responsible really for overseeing both. Was responsible for both funds. I think that the dynamic that potentially changes with the post fund being merged with the active is that previously the retirees were separate. Their annual increases were came from the post fund. Now that the two funds are merged, they're everyone's sort of under the same umbrella, the same fund, and the financial interests are all in one fund. So I think the dynamics have changed somewhat, but I think it's correct to say that our boards were also had the concerns of retirees in mind, whether they're in the separate post fund or a combined active and post fund.
And when you had that separate post fund with retirees only, there wasn't a separate group of retirees that had input or oversight over that fund. It was the whole TRA board, right?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. You're correct.
Okay. Also, let me acknowledge Representative Mary Murphy from Hermantown, the vice chair of the commission. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'm sorry I'm late. I didn't know it was so far.
Okay.
And I didn't know I couldn't speed as much as I like to.
Do I ask if there were any consequences?
No consequences. I just knew that there were 60-mile-an-hour signs. Instead of 70
mile an hour. Like in Hermantown, okay.
So I'm sorry.
Do you want to just
Representative Murphy, I hope you took advantage of the 10 miles oval whenever you were passing someone.
I never got a chance to pass Hardy. It's just too late. Except there were those little pull-out things, which I did to the big trailer I passed. I'm sorry.
Do you want to describe health district that you represent to us?
Oh, I represent mostly urban or suburban Duluth area from Scanlon, Proctor, Hermantown. I have 5 precincts in Duluth, and I have 2 townships, Midway, Kenosha, and Rice Lake in St. Louis County, and I have, like I said, Scanlon and the city of Thompson and the Thompson Township in Carlton County.
And Representative Murphy was the prior chair of this commission when the House had the chair, and she's now currently the vice chair of the commission.
And I embraced the idea of coming to Bemidji, to Senator Olson's district. I just missed half an inch on my nap.
It's only a half hour. Okay. No, that's fine. We're still basically on the first major topic here. Any other questions of TRA? Because I'm interested in also the other funds, because it does have implications there, too. Any questions of the members here? Ms. Hacking, anything for or
questions
about Nelson?
Ms. Hacking, you talked about having them elected. Would the retirees then both be elected at the same time, or do you want the terms staggered like the other members of the board?
I don't think we have a strong preference about that, just that we would like it in an odd number year. These elections run us about $30,000 to $40,000 in costs, and most of those really just mailing costs. If this were to be in 2013, it would align with our current retiree elections, so there would be some cost benefit there. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you may not want to wait that long to have it effective. So 2011, we could make that work as well. So
this may not be a fair question because I guess the TRA board ultimately hires the executive director, but I want to make sure that the members of not only your board, but other boards actually are involved, engaged, show up for the meetings and so forth. Can we... are you able to tell us whether or not the current board members are fully showing up and engaged as they're in doing the job that they're all supposed to do, every one of them?
Absolutely. You can see from our minutes that pretty much 100% attendance. It's very rare for them to miss a meeting. And I can tell you I've worked for many boards in my career, and they're very diligent about reading their materials and being very prepared. So
Mr. Burke's memo did talk about the balance of power, or I guess that's, I don't know if that's quite the word I want to use, but the fact that you have a certain number of appointees, a certain number of elected members and so forth, and if we start skewing it one way or the other, that ultimately is going to affect board decisions, even recommendations to the legislature as what you'd like to see, and I guess we would have to be cautious about that, too, because, for instance, it's fairly easy if you get too many retirees and say they want benefit increases. Well, if we can't afford them, that puts us in an awkward position there, too. So if adding one retiree to the board of TRA were to be done, is that going to change the dynamics? Is it going to affect the quality information we get? How is that going to work out?
Mr. Chair, I'd say a one-person change is not likely to really affect the dynamics that significantly. Again, as our board members are very mindful that regardless of who elects them or who appoints them, they're really there for the entire fund, for all the participants in the fund, as well as the state and taxpayers. So that's part of our legal counsel advice. Our legal counsel gives that advice to our board members before they're making any decisions where there needs to be some balance. So I think that is such a predominant element of our culture of decision making that to change the board, with one position one way or the other, I don't think would change that culture.
Okay, thank you. Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I'm not sure if it's best answered by Ms. Hacking or not, but we'll look for some advice on that. But I'm trying to better understand the need and the rationale for bringing this forward. And I wonder if has there been some circumstance or circumstances in the past that have perhaps led to the development of this effort? Or is it more directly related to the fact that the funds have merged? So I'm trying to understand do we feel like we've experienced a problem that we're seeking to address?
By the way, I see some lights are on the microphone, so apparently we do have, I don't know if you can you hear us better now?
Yes.
Okay. And let the record reflect we do have a quorum. Okay. Ms. Hacking?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, I think that question should probably be directed to the retirees who really are promoting this proposal. Again, the board is neutral on it and did not feel like it wanted to advance or suggest this. So I think they could probably shed light on that.
And we'll be inviting testimony from them, too, if they so wish. Sarah Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just on behalf I think if there's someone here to speak to this issue who can speak, who's a retiree who would like to speak directly, I think that's wonderful. But having been approached by the group, I can maybe share some information that might help Senator Lynch. And I just also wanted to point out that there are a couple of letters here for the members to look at.
one from the Retired Educators Association of Minnesota in support of this, and the other from the Education Minnesota Retired Teachers Organization. I think that the statement I was referring to in Mr. Burke's memo, Senator Wetzel, is on page 2, where it says, right below the chart, about halfway through that paragraph, he says, some of the considerable increase in the TRA 2006 through 2008 retiree active member ratio is due to the merger. So from an administrative standpoint, I understand what the chair was saying, but I think when this was brought to my attention and I was asked to bring this forward for discussion, I think a lot of this has to do with that growing increase in the ratio of retirees versus active members, recognizing and certainly not complaining about the job that's being done by the people who are on the board. So I was never told that people were, that there was some precipitating particular event, if that answers the question, but more of a question that as there's been an increase in the number of retirees and more likely to be an even greater increase, that would be, just like we all like to have someone representing more directly the group that we are in, I think that was the rationale.
Well, I think if I'm reading that part correctly, though, I think that may be referring to the moving the Minneapolis teachers into TRA, which affected their numbers because they had a higher number of retirees, and that affected the overall balance.
Right.
So it wasn't the post-fund merger, the active, that was the Minneapolis fund, which does affect the numbers in here, too.
Right.
I am, again, if MSRS, PERA, or some of the agency mayor fund wishes to give us some thoughts or advice, because this is only TRA, but you know what's coming up next. You know, if the commission decides to approve it, does this... are there any things that you can think of that we should be aware of? Ms. Vanek, welcome back to the commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. PERA already has two retiree representatives. One is appointed by the governor, and one is elected by the membership at large. All five of our elected members, in fact, are elected by the entire membership at large. All retirees, all active members have a vote in the representation of those through those five elected positions. They're dedicated, three to the general plan, one police and fire, one and one retired, but the retired folks do have a voice in all representation. And I will just ask you to recall Ms. Hacking's testimony on fiduciary obligation and the board's taking very seriously the fact that whether they're appointed or elected, they are there to represent the beneficiaries of the fund and to take into consideration the taxpayers in the state of Minnesota in general when they make decisions. So we're comfortable thus far that our board is in good shape. One thing I will bring to your attention, we have been approached by a member of the correctional plan about having a position dedicated to that plan on the Board of Trustees. The board hasn't taken a position on it. There's been no legislation advanced, but that is something that you could see coming forward in the next year or so if the individual decides to pursue that.
Thank you. Any questions? And again, if anybody has any PERA-specific questions, Ms. Vanek is the one that you'd wish to talk to. Mr. Bergstrom, welcome back to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yep, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. Our board looked at this issue about 4 years ago, and at that time they looked at adding a retiree elected position. At that time they decided not to bring it forward. Since this was on the agenda, it is an issue for discussion at our upcoming board meeting. So in September when we meet, our board will be discussing adding a retiree representative, and they're also going to be looking at adding a deferred representative, somebody who is no longer a state employee but has not started to collect. I think we have about 13,000 deferred members, so that is becoming a bigger proportion of our membership as well. So we're looking at both the retiree and for our deferred members as well. In the past, the University of Minnesota also has asked for board representation, and the board decided not to bring that forward as well.
Thank you. Any questions? As you can see from the testimony we received, whenever the Pension Commission does anything, other people come in later on and cite that as precedent. Well, you did it here, so you're going to have to do it there. So we take very seriously each decision we make, because we realize that it does usually set a trend here. We do have, thank you, Ms. Bergstrom. Any questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bergstrom, are your members all elected or is someone appointed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we have a mix. We have four elected to our general plan. We have a state patrol elected member. We have a correctional plan elected member. We have three governor appointees. We have one member appointed by the Metropolitan Transit drivers and one elected retiree. I think that adds up to 11, I hope. So we have three appointed by the governor. Historically, one of those positions, for the most part, has been one retiree. So right now our board has an elected retiree and appointed retiree as well.
And
Representative
Murphy. Mr. Chair, there's this historical appointment in MSRS and then in PERA by the governor that just has been passed down from year to year?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Did some governor say, oh, I want my candidate?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Bergstrom.
Representative Murphy, it's just since I've been on the board, I think for most of that time we've had one. I don't know the history of it or why, but what usually happens, the governor's appointment staff kind of solicits people who want to run, and that's how they get the pool of candidates.
Okay, any questions? Okay, as we indicated, we already have two letters, one dated August 7, 2009 from Charles Hiley, and another letter dated August 5 from Walter Munsterman. He's the president of Education Minnesota Retired. Do we have anybody here present who wishes to testify to the commission on this issue? Would you come forward? Please identify yourself for the record.
I am Charles Helley, and I'm from Sauk Center.
Okay, we do have your letter. Go ahead.
And I'm president of REAM, Retired Educators Association of Minnesota. We have about 9,000 members, and we represent not only retired teachers, but administrators and nurses, classroom aides, secretaries, cooks, and custodians. And REAM supports Senate File 1601 and House File Senate 1793, which adds a second retired member to the TRA board. The present TRA board has four active members, and there is one retired educator. A TRA has approximately two active members for every one retired member at present. We believe this is a question of equal representation and fairness. In 10 to 15 years, projections are there will be one active member of TRA for every retired member. With an additional retiree on TRA, there will be a total of 9 TRA board members, which would help avoid tie votes. We had the post fund and active fund merged June 30th, and I believe there was more money in the post fund than there was in the active fund, like about $2 billion. And I could be off $1 billion or so there, but I believe there was more money in the post fund than in the active fund. PERA board presently has 4 active members and 2 retirees, which you have heard, and also the MSRS board also has the same numbers, 4 active and 2 retirees. We believe that the costs to add a second retiree member to the TRA board is minor. And there would be election costs, like printing of ballots, postage, and tallying the ballots. Also, there would be transportation, conference, and convention costs for an additional member to the TRA board. REAM supports adding one retiree to the TRA board, and we hope you will support this addition to the TRA board, too.
Mr. Hogg, is it Heil?
Helley.
Just,
you know, Helley. H-E-L-L, Helley.
Helley, gotcha. Mr. Helley, do your members feel that there has been some unfairness or they've been at a disadvantage the way that the board is currently comprised?
I don't think we feel that way. I think we just feel there should be more representation since the funds are merged now, too, as well.
But when they were separate...
I don't think we felt that there was a problem with it.
Okay. if anything, I think, you know, when we talked about the merger, the possible merger of the active employees with the retirees, it was the active employees that felt the most concerned then, because they felt that if that were to happen, then they would be assuming the liabilities of a post fund. Mm-hmm. And so the active employees may very well say, well, we think we ought to have more representation now, too, because we want to make sure that, you know, we're not, you know, that things are going to be fair, because they in especially Education Minnesota, strongly opposed, you know, the possibility of merger, but, you know, that's it happened. So mm-hmm. so I'm a bit concerned to make sure that, you know, the parties are adequately represented and that we don't have other people saying, well, we want to add more people to it to make the board even larger. So what considerations should we have there?
Well, it's 4-1 right now. Mm-hmm. We're asking for more representation on there because we think it would help in decisions that are made.
Okay.
We do know they have to represent the entire state, but we do feel we should have more representation than one out of four actives. And it isn't that long, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, you're going to have one retiree for every active TRE member.
So then would the retirees be asking for more membership then?
Could be. I don't know.
Okay.
But I don't think if you're worried about a big power change, I don't think there's that big a power change. But we do think we should have more representation.
What issues do you see that an additional retiree would bring forward that the court are not being brought forward?
Well, you got two people. They would be representing maybe more than one opinion, retiree opinion. You got two. You know, you got four actives. They represent four different opinions as far as actives go too.
Okay. I think Sarah Lynch.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Helley alluded to the fact that they don't believe that an additional person would create additional cost to the system, or I think you said minimal, and I'm wondering if staff would care to comment on that.
Well, I think that would probably be a TRA question. Is hacking would adding an additional board member, regardless where it comes from, what would be some of the costs that TRA would have, and how are those paid for?
Mr. Chair, Laurie Hacking with TRA, the additional cost would really be mainly for the election. And if the election were coincident with our existing retiree spot, there really wouldn't be much additional cost at all, because we're already conducting an election for a retiree slot, so it's just another name on the ballot, so there wouldn't be any real additional costs. If you decide to put it in the 2011 year rather than 2013, there would be some additional costs, you know, in the range of $30,000 to $40,000. That would probably be on the high side. But other than those election costs, I can't really foresee. You know, there are some incidental expenses of traveling to board meetings, but that's pretty minor.
And those costs all come out of the TRA funds?
Yes.
Sir Olson?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask Mr. Helley how he felt or how he felt believed his members would feel about perhaps postponing this, as has been suggested, to minimize costs, or, you know, how strong the feelings are about doing this sooner rather than later.
Well, I think we'd like to have the representation as soon as possible, but, you know, I guess that's, you know, $30,000. I don't know. I think the budget's much bigger than $30,000. So, but, you know, I guess we wouldn't be opposed to it. I mean, we'd like to have it as soon as we can get it. And I'm sure if you had it in 2011, I think you'd still have take office for a short time after the election decides.
Well, as we indicated, the bill as drafted would have gone into effect this past June, but July 1st, and so since it can't pass, nothing could pass until next year anyway, we do have to make an adjustment there. I asked Mr. Burke if he would kind of come up with some ideas. He had the 1A amendment, but we had some thoughts that maybe we could look at a different way. Mr. Burke, do you have any thoughts here?
Mr. Chairman, members, if one wanted to implement what Ms. Hacking was suggesting with TRA and have the election on June 30th, 2011 without any transition. I would suggest the following amendment to you, and the amendment would be on page 2, line 8, delete the day following final enactment and insert June 30th, 2011. And the second change would be page 2, delete lines 9 to 14. And with those changes, the election would be in 2011 without any transition.
Okay, that's a proposal. Again, it's something that the commission may or may not wish to be looking at, but Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I had a question for Ms. Hacking. That's when she spoke about if the election's in 2011, you have staggered terms, isn't there already election in 2011? Adding a retiree to that election, how is that going to cost $30,000 to $40,000 more? If there's already an election going on, you've got staggered terms, 2011, 2013 would be the, at least, maybe I'm mistaken.
Ms. Hacking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm sorry, what probably wasn't clear. Our retiree, our one retiree election is in 2013.
So if we
and so the, and that means the mailing has to go out to retirees. If we already, that's already in current law. If we had an election in 2011, which is would be also coincident with our active members, but those active members ballots only go to active members, not retirees. So there's an additional mailing cost if we're doing it in 11 versus 13. So that's
but
the only difference.
If we adopt Mr. Burke's proposed amendment, then. And if there were two retirees, then the terms would be staggered. One would be in 2011 and one would be 2013.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, got it. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Betzel. Ms. Hacking, could you give us some history on the returns from your mailings for voting purposes?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, our participation rate among retirees has generally been in about the 30 to 35% range of, thank you. In our last, let's hold on. Oh. Just to double check here. Actives, retirees, yeah. In 2009, our response rate was about 37%. That's down a bit from, like, back in 1975, it was 43, but it's been in that range, if that helps. Our active participation rate is quite a bit lower. It's more like 10%.
Hmm. More like what?
10, in the most recent election.
Okay, I think we had somebody else who wanted to testify, so a second. Mr. Come on forward to the podium, if you could. Please identify yourself for the record. And thank you, Mr. Helley.
Yes.
Welcome to the Pension Commission.
Hutchins. I'm a retired teacher from St. Cloud, Minnesota. I'm also a member of REAM, that was mentioned, and I'm also a member of Education Minnesota Retirees. I've been looking at pension issues for a long time, since 1970. I retired from the St. Cloud Public Schools 3 years ago after 37 years in the classroom. And what I've given you in front of you is basically a focus on the numbers of retirees and how it's been increasing. But before I talk about that, I want to answer from a retiree perspective, some of the concerns that were brought up by Senator Lynch and Senator Olson and Representative Nelson. The first one, in the 1970s, when I started following pension issues, we had one retiree on the board for 5,000 retirees. If you look at what you're talking about right now, 2011, we'll easily have 50,000 retirees. It's still one retiree if we don't have a second representative. Some of the issues retirees have brought to me would include, since the post fund was eliminated, a lot of retirees feel they've lost their identity to the post fund as a concern, whether it's valid or not. If you look at the sheet I gave you, by statute, and this was brought up by Ms. Hackey and Senator Olson alluded to it, by statute, the trustees in Minnesota on public employee boards, they are bound by duty, fiduciary duty, to the state, the taxpayer, and their constituents. If you look at any of the other states, they're bound basically by ERISA, the law that was set in place in 1974. Most states, the trustees on these boards are bound to duty only to their members. But in Minnesota, it's different. And as Ms. Hacking said, the trustees on these boards are very diligent about being serious about who they represent. But if you look at our retirees, how they look at things, they perceive the trustees as their representative, speaking for them. And if you look at one representative for 5,000 and now one representative for 50,000, and you look at what Mr. Helley said, in the next 10 to 15 years, easily it's going to be one-on-one. We don't feel asking for one more retiree on board is going to cause that much of a, what do you call it, train wreck on the board. It's not going to be that big of an issue. If you look at the taxpayer and you look at how the boards have operated in Minnesota, I think the taxpayers, as a retiree and what I've been told, have done an excellent job representing the taxpayer. I think if you look at your committee, when you look at the recommendations coming from MSRS, PERA, TRA, I think they've done an excellent job of keeping you informed. With two retirees on the board, it gives the retirees a bigger visibility. It gives them a more equitable presence. And researching this issue with other states, Mr. Helley mentioned the issue of fairness. Most of the states we've talked to, that's the bottom line. As an example, Illinois recently had another retiree, and that was the main issue, fairness to the retirees. If you look at the sheet I gave you, and you look at the charts, all three of them, I don't want to spend too much time because there's already been a duplication of topics, but if you look at the first graph on the third page, if you look at down at the bottom, the baby boomer group, the group that's seriously thinking about retiring, there's over 25,000 people nearing retirement, easily over 50, that are teachers in the state. Now, if they all retired, that's over 70,000 retirees compared to the number of actives being in the 70,000 range. That's a big presence. if you look at the next couple tables, you can see that the distribution of active members all the way through the baby boomer group is well, almost every year there, it's nearing 10,000 or more that would be nearing retirement. The retiree group is going to be growing and growing. About 6 years ago, the Mellon actuarial firm, some of you remember it, maybe it was Buck Consultants, they did a 20-year study for TRA, and they found the group of retirees growing very fast. The reason it won't, all those people retiring won't increase totally the number of retirees in the state is because of the concept of mortality. We lose roughly 800 teachers a year by passing away. That's the other thing that offsets the total number. But if you look at the sheets I've given you, you'll see that there's a big booming group nearing retirement. And looking at the makeup of the TRA board, 8 members, that's one of the smallest boards in the state. If you look at adding one more member, if you look at the dynamics, like Representative Nelson mentioned, going from 37% by the so-called state representatives that are appointed down to 33%, that's still roughly a third. I don't think that would change the dynamics on the board that much, but it would sure make a nice impression for the retiree public employees of this state, especially the teachers, if they knew that this group was considering them having more presence on the board, more visibility, and more representation. Now I'll open it up for questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hutchins. I've got a question.
I've been up since 5:30, so.
Well, so I have some more members here, too.
And you have, too.
Yeah. I do have a question or two, because, I mean, you indicated that some of your retired members are concerned about the merger of the proposed fund
with
the active fund, but nothing really changed as far as the TRA board was still the same. They oversaw both the active and the post fund. It just happened to be one fund instead of two, but it wasn't like we had a separate board that oversaw the post fund, so I'm a little concerned as to why they would see that that was a pleasant promise.
Chairman Betzel, if you remember a person by the name of Ed Rapp, whenever he comes and whenever he testifies to the TRA Board of Trustees or Education Minnesota members, he talks about that post fund as being very sacred. He talks about it in relationship to being retiree money. That money is basically money that was set aside for retirees. And as Mr. Helley mentioned, when the merger took place, the post fund had much more money in it at that time than the active fund. So they look at it a little differently than, you know, some of us might. They looked at that as their own money.
But the merger had to take place because the post funds were running into trouble.
Yeah. Well, if
that's the reason why it happened, and spending post fund down wouldn't solve that. So,
if you look at the history and you look at what the Legislative Commission staff mentioned, if you look at history since 1970, whenever the funds were in decline, the state did step in through up until 1998 and kicked in supplemental money. If you look back, not counting right now, but well, it's 2.64 now. But if you look back historically till 1998, the state was kicking in 3.14% of average pay, normal pay of payroll, more than the employee. Whenever there was a deficiency, there's a lot of people in that post fund, the retirees, that were assuming, because they only had two sources, the retirees coming in, the money was transferred from the active fund to the post fund, and then investment returns. Since 1980, very little money was coming into that fund. There is now because of Minneapolis, but very little money was coming from the state directly. They were thinking, if you look historically, like a lot of retirees do, because that's what they lived, they were assuming maybe the state could have helped the post fund now that it was in a decline.
Well,
they look at things differently.
That wasn't going to happen. That's why we had the merger.
Right.
The state hasn't got any money to bail out post funds.
But this is the mentality of retirees, yeah. Senator
well,
Bensel.
But the issue, you know, I mean, fairness to one is unfairness to another. We're, you know, I think we're interested in making sure that the people who are on the board have a fiduciary responsibility to the whole fund, the active members, the taxpayer dollars that are in there, every part of it, and not just to be there to lobby for, you know, one group or another. That's
right.
Not the role of the board.
I think if you look at the makeup of the boards as the three directors mentioned, those trustees are very diligent. They do want to follow the state statute. They do want to represent the state, the taxpayer, and their members. But if you look at the way retirees look at things, they look at things a little differently as far as a presence on the board. The board itself, I think, would still be very diligent in their duties.
Any questions, Mr. Hutchinson? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just summarize it, or I guess see it in my mind this way. I don't think that we're hearing from the retirees that anyone is challenging or questioning the fiduciary responsibility that's been carried
Correct.
Out, the integrity of anyone that's on the board, or that they are claiming that their rights aren't being taken into consideration. But I would look at it more like those of us sitting here on the commission. I mean, there are things we'd like to do for people that we can't do. I mean, we'd like to do for our constituents that we can't do because we have to take into consideration actuarial realities and fiduciary responsibilities, taxpayers versus, you know, our individual constituents. And yet we each have a voice representing an area of the state that, you know, allows us to add those different points of view. And I guess that's how I kind of look at this, not as a challenge, but just recognizing the realities of the changing dynamic of the retirees versus active numbers, and just looking at it that way as wanting to have a voice in from a fairness perspective, not as a criticism of anything that's already happened.
Any other questions of this witness? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify?
Thank you for your time.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this issue? If not, members, we've got to do some administrative cleanup before we consider it any further, do anything, just because the effective days don't work anymore. So what is there a pleasure of the commission as to how you wish to handle this? We have the 1A amendment that's part of your packet. Mr. Burke read some additional language, which would just basically have it go into effect on June 30th of 2011. Representative Nelson.
I'd like to move that amendment.
The Burke Amendment?
The Burke Amendment, yes.
Okay. And that amendment basically, if you look at the bill on page 2, line 8, after the word effective, it strikes the rest of the sentence and inserts June 30th, 2011, and then it deletes the language from 2.9 to 2.14. Basically, if this were to be adopted, that would simply make it effective in June 30th, 2011. So we're not approving the concept here. We're just trying to put the bill in the shape where it makes sense, because it doesn't make any sense right now the way it was drafted, because it was not acted on this last session. So is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. The motion is adopted. The amendment is adopted. Okay, folks. Representative Kahn.
Before we turn away from this, I'm just, I think this is a compliment to the diligence of staff to make sure that everything is placed before us. But have we ever looked at the idea of Statement 1, the question of whether pension boards are needed, and whether all the statewide plan administrators should be eliminated and the function moved to the State Department? I don't think I've ever seen that before us. And I noticed you were letting it go by without any comment on it, so.
I have a comment. Does somebody wish to? I mean, you can see the turf wars in just adding one member of one board. I mean, boy, if you started eliminating all the boards, boy, we'd be here a lot longer. Sometimes you like sleeping dogs lie, but it's a good question.
I didn't want it really discussed in the question of this bill, but I just commented if someone had a longer memory than me and had seen some discussion on this before.
Ms. Martin's apparently got some thoughts.
Members, I don't want to get into the debate on the issue, but from a historical perspective, in the late 80s, there was a proposal, in 88 or 89, for creating a department of pensions rather than having the various pension funds have their own administrative staff. And if you go back, that was heard by the commission but not approved by the commission. Prior to that, in 1971, the Loan Executive Action Program, which was a function of recommendations for notions of former Governor Wendell Anderson, in creating a personnel department, which became DOER, which now got folded back into moved to finance. Part of the creation of the personnel department was to include the various pension funds, but that did not successfully survive the 73 session.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. What's the pleasure of the commission? Anybody, any thoughts? Any discussion?
Well, Chairman, are you looking for a motion to?
Well, if you'd like to do it, if you want,
if you
wish to. Now, I did tell the, I did announce at the last meeting we wouldn't be taking any really hard votes here. If it's the will, if you feel fully informed and are ready to act on it, we could do that. If you wanted to lay it over to discuss at the next meeting when we have the other members who are not here present, but we're still going to be missing members at any meeting that we have, so. I mean, we usually try to act on things when we have all the information fresh in our heads. Representative Nelson.
As the House author of the bill, I think we should lay it over for the full discussion. Seeing as how we originally announced that we weren't going to take hard votes.
Okay.
I
did announce it at the last meeting that because we were meeting in a different location and some people could not make it up at this meeting, I try to avoid any binding things that members who were not present, you know, could not participate in it. Now, we've got a full record here. We understand the issue quite well. I think in fairness to the members who, you know, couldn't make the trip, I think it'd be just appropriate just to lay it over. We'll be on the agenda at our next meeting. And we should be able to make a decision one way or the other at that point. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, and I'm supportive of laying this over, I wonder perhaps someone from either the retirees or the TRA board could comment. Has this proposal been, how has this been communicated to the retirees in our districts?
I don't know, the TRA board said, well, maybe the retirees could comment on that one. So. Mr. Helley?
In our, Mr. Helley, Chuck Helley, in our re-news, we have been telling that we're promoting this, that our board has approved it, and we pursued it with Senator Nelson and Senator Olson and Senator Nelson. Representative Nelson, sorry.
Whatever.
We proposed it and asked them to sponsor the bill. And our members know that we don't have everybody in the state that's retired, but we do have about 9,000. There's many more than that that are retired, but they do know about it, that we're pursuing this.
And by the way, we did adopt an amendment to change the effective date, but if anybody sees any problems with it between now and the next time we take the bill up, obviously, you know, you can certainly bring that to our attention because sometimes, you know, we realize that, oops, we need to make adjustments here. I mean, it seems to make sense right now. But okay, with that, then I will lay over Senate File 1601 and House File 1793. And again, for the members of the audience, this is how we normally operate. It may seem slow and tedious, but we do want to be fully informed on the issues that come before us and make good decisions so that when we have our final pension bill, it's well thought of. I'd like to start take up the third item on our agenda. We'll see how the time frame goes. As I say, we will be taking a break at some point so that we can have people take a stretch and like that. But I think the third one might go a little bit quicker, so let's take a quick look at that one. Mr. Martin, is this yours? Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Members, I direct you to the July 23rd memo. It's the second item in the practice. Second policy memo in the packet. This has to do with Mary's dissolution and retirement plan benefits. Briefly, there are proposed legislation in the hopper currently that would modify the election of joint and survivor optional annuities based on a marriage dissolution order. While this doesn't cover that legislation, that's something that will be scheduled later in the fall. This is an attempt to at least provide the first background look at the topic of how pensions and a divorce works out. I've broken the memo into several parts. The first item, pension benefits have been recognized as marital property for a good long period of time, both by the courts and specifically in statute since 1978. The bottom of page one, how Minnesota pension plans have dealt with property divisions that following a divorce. Federal law in 1974 provided a procedure for allocating property in a divorce, and they established something known as a quadro, the Qualified Domestic Relations Order. That's a largely private sector pension plan phenomenon. Before 1987, Minnesota public pension plans not being covered by ERISA, the Employee Income Security Act. Our law did not permit even the enforcement of a marriage dissolution award that divided pension benefits in favor of the second payee. There was a non-assignment, non-garnishment provision that extended through marriage dissolution judgments. So before 1987, if an ex-spouse was awarded a portion of the other spouse's pension benefits, the only way that they could enforce that would be against the other member, the other spouse's bank account, not the pension plan. In 1987, that changed in a piece of legislation that the Pension Commission did act on, which did permit division of marital property in the form of pension benefits between both spouses. But it set certain conditions, mostly to make sure that the division of the pension benefit as marital property did not increase the liability of the pension fund. And those our conditions are set forth in the bottom of page one, in the top of page two. There is some confusion, probably among the practicing bar, that the practicing lawyers may be familiar with the quadro procedures of the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, because public employees represent a subset of all possible divorces. The practicing bar may not be as knowledgeable about the Minnesota state law on property divisions. Joint survivor optional annuity forms are a way for a pension fund member who's retiring to provide, in effect, insurance with respect to another person. Prior to a year or two ago, these were elected by an individual with notice to the person's spouse, but no requirement that the spouse also approve of the election of the pension benefit. Since 2008, we have changed our form of our pension benefit for at least married public pension plan members for from a single life annuity, that being a benefit measured by the lifetime of the pension plan member, to an automatic 50% joint and survivor unless the our recipient and the recipient spouse both approve a different form. So single life annuity can be selected a different joint and survivor annuity. Duration or length or measure could be selected. A 75% joint survivor, 100% joint survivor could be elected, but if all else fails, the benefit would be paid in the form of a 50% joint and survivor. That means that a reduced benefit would be paid to the retiree, and upon the death of a retiree, if they predecease the survivor, the spouse, half of the prior benefit amount would be payable to the surviving spouse. There's more here about optional annuities, and I also included page 3 a listing of the current optional annuity forms utilized by the various pension plans. There's no provision in the applicable Minnesota law, section 518.581, that clearly indicates that a district court can void a retirement annuity form election at the time of a marriage dissolution, although sometimes that does happen. And the pension plans are do not recognize that order. It's contrary. It's not supported by Minnesota law. But that's where sometimes the rub occurs. At some point, as part of the property division, an attempt is made to return from an optional annuity form to a single life annuity by voiding the optional annuity election after the fact, and that is not supported by Minnesota law. When we do take up the pending legislation, there's both general legislation, generally applicable, and more specific legislation, that's the thrust of the software change. There will be a full issue memo when we do take up those bills. This gives you a sense of what the status of current Minnesota law is.
Yep. I asked to have this on the agenda because we do have a couple of bills out there that are probably going to be coming before the commission dealing with some aspects of marriage dissolution judgments and decrees and how it affects pension issues. On this pension commission, we see a lot of issues coming to us because people at one point in their life just have to make decisions as to what they want the pension to look like, and we get a lot of people coming before us who want to change what they opted for simply because circumstances changed. Somebody died too early or lived too long or something changed or divorce came along. I think that the bottom line here I think is something we need to keep in mind is that I don't think we do want to go down the road where we allow the courts to just kind of open up and make changes into the decisions that were made because that's going to wreak havoc on the pension funds because they kind of figure out, you know, how much down the road, how much the costs are going to be, and if you change that through court action, you know, after the fact, that will change all the assumptions that were made and be more costly to all the members of the fund. But as I say, this is kind of a sort of a introduction piece. I'll ask the commission members if you have any comments or thoughts on this topic. I'll see if there's anybody here who wants to comment on it as well. Any comments, Sarah Lynch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had a conversation with a constituent about an issue that would fall under this umbrella, I think. I wonder if it would be possible for staff to put together a list for us if there are, I don't know if these bills have been introduced or if you are thinking that they will be introduced.
Well, as I've indicated, certainly any bills that have been introduced, you know, we're going to schedule them for discussion over the interim. If there are new issues that people want to bring forward, I don't want to wait until the start of the 2010 session. If people are already aware of issues right now, staff can prepare something that looks exactly like a bill, and we can start talking about it and thinking about it. They just can't introduce it, but you know, I don't need to have an actual bill in front of us to work on some things. So So we do encourage people to bring forward issues. Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this up. I know I have at least one constituent as well whose issue I think follows under this broader umbrella. But from what I've heard from others, this apparently does come up fairly frequently, you know, from time to time. I think the interesting thing also is looking through this document that Mr. Martin put together, and as an attorney myself, but not having practiced in this area, I don't know much about this. I was fascinated, though, that apparently we have a different system for public employees and is generally there in the private sector, and wanting to try to make it as understandable as possible for people so we don't have situations arising where at least where inadvertent things are happening, whether it's if there's anything we can be doing to simplify the process and also make it easier for the attorneys representing people. I'd recommend that anyone get a copy of your memo if they're looking at a good overview of the differences here. And I was also really surprised to see how many different optional annuity forms there were among the different retirement plans. You know, it seems like there's a lot of room for confusion and mistakes there too, just because there's so many differences. So it does seem to me that whatever we can do to make sure the courts are following the law and reducing confusion would be worth our time.
So, Ms. Martin.
With respect to Senator Lynch's question, there are two bills. Senator Betzel is the author of one of the bills and has been introduced during the 2009 session. Representative Erdahl is the other bill, the House author. I think there are companions for both bills, but I don't recall the members or recall the companion authors. We did want to at least start the topic here, but we didn't want to have Representative Erdahl have to travel up here when we're not going to be taking action. It seemed to be an inconvenience or an inappropriate action on the part of the bench commission to have an author come to a hearing when nothing is actually going to take place or no possibility of anything taking place, which is why we're doing this in more than one part. But there are at least two bills in. Senator Lynch has a question.
Yeah,
Senator Olson's question. Also.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin, it would be helpful to me in working with my constituent if we could have a follow-up with identifying both of those bills. I think that would help
sure.
me to determine if my situation might fit in there or not, and then I can follow
well,
up.
Well, yeah, talk to staff over the next few weeks, and if it doesn't fit in, just have something drafted up that we can look at the same time we look at the other issues.
With respect to Senator Olson's comment about trying to make Minnesota law as compatible with federal law as possible, the problem with the federal law is it does allow the second life or the second spouse to start drawing a benefit at a time other than when the retiree starts drawing a benefit, and as a consequence can add to the liability of the pension fund. One of the things that was done in 1987, and the reason why the pension funds did not oppose the 87 change was that it did not increase the liability of the public employee pension plan, which at least in some aspects the federal law could. So there is going to be a rub. I believe that we ought to have our laws conform to general practice as set by the federal government as much as possible where it makes sense. But I think we are going to have a rub because of the liability issue. If a second life on a in an award of marital property can start their benefit at a much different time than when the retiree wants to start drawing their benefits, that can create additional liability. Now, it also has led to two pieces of legislation that the commission has dealt with in recent years. There, Senator Jeff Michel, when he was on the pension commission, had a constituent whose spouse would not retire, in part to deny her the start of the benefit. And that was dealt with a piece of special legislation. And then former Senator Steve Novak sought a piece of legislation a couple of years ago to allow his division of pension benefits in a divorce start early, but those were fully adjusted for the actuarial consequences. So it did not create any additional liability for the pension fund. Doing things on a one-person basis is a very inappropriate or difficult way of resolving problems.
Yeah, that issue that Senator Novak was involved with was the fact that he wanted to keep working, but he also wanted his wife to be able to start taking her share of the pension. And she wasn't entitled to it until he quit working. So, yeah, and those issues are going to come up. You know, and so we had a special legislation, but we figured at some point down the road we need to come up with some rule so that they can divide them out. So whether it's, he actually wanted to help his wife out, whereas the one of Senator Michelle was somebody who just wanted to spite his spouse. I'll keep working because you're not going to get a dime until I retire, and I'm not going to retire. You know, so I mean, we have to figure out those issues. There's a lot of complicated things that go on.
Well,
Mr.
Chairman, as long as these things can be done so that they're actuarially neutral,
right.
Is there any objection to doing them? Is there any problem? I mean, I know that that's just the statistical point, not an actual point.
And
I thought that, like many of the times when we allow people to buy back benefits, mm-hmm. We're always pretty cautious to make sure that they have to do it at the actuarial value. But is there any problem with letting it be as free as possible as long as the actuarial responsibilities are taken care of?
Representative Kahn, I can't think of any, but that's one of the reasons why I wanted to put it on the agenda so we can start looking at those issues and see if there's any problems down the road on them. So. Is there anybody here who wants to... Mr. Rice, welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chairman Brian Rice, attorney for the Minneapolis Police Relief Association, Fire Relief Association. This issue originally was brought to the legislature by Representative Kathleen Blatt. She chaired the Judiciary Committee back in 85 and 86 and had a constituent that had a problem with this very issue. They didn't address the legislation that year, but I worked with her and Pension Commission staff in 87. And as Mr. Martin, he made the key point there. For the pension fund's perspective, you don't want an order under the ERISA federal system, a quadro or a division of these pension assets to result in an increase in liability of the public pension funds. And that's really the stellar or the pole star, the main point of the 87 legislation. And as a practitioner, I'll tell you, it's generally worked. I mean, one of the advantages of representing these folks for a long time, they don't get as divorced as much. You know, the average age is in the 70s, so the incidence of marital disharmony. Larry Ward here has been married 49 years, and
that's right.
Hopefully that union will continue until death do they part. But there was an incident, and there is some burden on the pension funds, and I'm sure the other pension funds that have open members still deal with these issues. But the bar, I would disagree with Senator Olson a little bit. I don't think it's your job to make it easier for the practicing divorce law lawyers in the state to understand. You know, they can open the books. They can read it. That's what they get paid for. There is a difference between the federal law and the state law, and that's the Constitution. I mean, you're the legislature. Congress can do what they want. You get to do what you want. You're responsible for these pensions. There hasn't been a federal bailout of the pensions yet. Maybe that'll happen. But on this area, I would really urge the commission to... That 87 law has worked pretty well. It's been around for 22 years. You run into some lawyers sometimes who don't know what they're doing, and you'll get a judge to make an order, and you got to tell the judge wrong. You wrote up the order wrong. They don't like to hear that, but the legislature gets to write the rules, and you don't get to change the rules. So, and I would say even in the two cases you've had, the facts have been unusual, but I think as a legislature, you want to go very slowly and not mess with this. It's worked so far, and if you start opening the door, there might be some policy implications because of the bill Representative Nelson had a year ago where you've now required joint annuity forms for everyone. The concerns that the old relief associations had is that there was an automatic survivor benefit, so that if you were married, the pension was worth 50%, again, as much if you stay married. But once you were divorced, that was the problem that you had here. The pension shrunk. So I think as you consider this, I would really urge the commission, the staff, and legislators, even though you'll hear the stories and it sounds really bad, and there might be these certain set of facts that sound, gosh, it's heartbreaking, and why didn't this person get some allocation, you really need to look at it in the context of, you know, several hundred thousand marriages of public employees and hundreds of billions, if not billions, of liabilities of funds. And so as you start thinking this thing through and you start wanting to take care of one situation, you might create a real liability problem for other plans, you know, going downstream. So we don't run into as much with Minneapolis Police and Fire. We did for a while there when it first passed. Occasionally you'll get a decree that comes on. Sometimes you'll get a decree that was awarded 10 or 15 years ago, and all of a sudden it pops up. You don't even know that. We for the most part, track it, but every once in a while somebody walks in with a divorce decree and says, give me my pension. And you say, wait a minute, you know, it doesn't quite work that way. And there is a lot of confusion there, but I don't think that's the, my own view is I don't think that's, you know, the commission staff or the legislatures. There's lawyers out there. They can open up the books. They should ask a question, where do you get your pension from? And they should know if it's from the federal government or the state government or a private employer or a, you know. So those are just some comments. We'll certainly monitor any efforts you do and offer comments if we see anything.
In one of my other lives as an Army officer, a judge advocate, Sir Olson's also former judge advocate as well too. I mean, the United States military has its laws. I mean, the Congress has passed laws saying this is what you get, and it always happens that these divorce decrees show up at the payment centers, you know, for the Army, the Air Force, or whatever, and they just don't follow them. And they say it's jurisdictional. I mean, you have to have, for instance, 10 years of service. It has to overlap with, if it's not there, it's not there. It doesn't matter what a judge signed. If it isn't there, they bounce it back, and unfortunately it does cause hardships because sometimes it was part of the negotiations with the parties in reaching their settlement. But if they didn't follow the law, there's nothing a judge can do about that.
Right. Yeah. So. The only thing I'd say, too, is that the commission does deal with a lot of these individual cases. I think this is an area where, you know, there is a principle there. I think that the biggest thing from the fund's perspective is we'll honor, or the funds have honored award, as long as it's not adding to the unfunded liability of the plan, or that it's, you know, some court saying, well, there's this an additional burden, and that gets to be tricky. And sometimes it's tough. Some people are well represented, some aren't. I know there was a case that a Wisconsin judge ordered the Minneapolis firefighters to pay a pension, and, you know, the judge got me on the phone and was not less than polite, and I said, you know, this is Minnesota law. I mean, you know, like, what are we going to do? We're not going to just change the order. I mean, if we were to just do what this judge said, you'd be yelling at us, Senator Betzold, and say, what the hell did you guys do?
Right.
And, you know, what kind of operation are you running? So,
any questions, Mr. Rice? Sarah Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Rice. And I guess I didn't mean to suggest it's our job to make life easy for attorneys. I mean, even though I am one. But I guess what I...
Remember, we'll just talk about poor lawyers.
Yeah. What I am concerned about just is, though, is that we try when we can not to leave people in situations that they weren't expecting, or that they'll, you know, where we... If this is a problem that tends to arise fairly frequently... But I have a question about the comment you made where you said we try to honor these as long as it doesn't make an actuarial difference. Mm-hmm. So does that mean that if a decree is written that isn't in conformity with the law but it isn't going to make a difference to the fund, that you do follow it or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, no, we require that they follow the law. And sometimes you'll see with lawyers that they're, you know, poorly drafted. And this area of, you know, as Mr. Martin knows, it's... you know, public pension law is a pretty unique area of the law. I mean, it's not what, you know, maybe public employment covers, state public employment maybe covers less than 10% probably of the population, so it's not the frequent model that people run into. And it's just something that has to be dealt with. And you hear from your constituents, they'll find you out and things like that. So, no, the plan's view is that we have to honor the law. The law that passed in 87, I would say, has held up pretty well over 22 years. There may be some ruffles that develop and, you know, certainly patterns of marriage dissolution, support, things like that change, too. I mean, when the law passed in the 80s, the model was still maybe the husband, you know, the whole marital arrangements changed a lot in terms of more women in the workforce and who's earning a pension and who isn't, and employment patterns changed. But it's, I would certainly urge you, as you consider it, get some feedback from the pension funds, from, you know, here with PRA, MSRS, the other funds are hearing about how they're administering it and what problems they see, because there's a lot of, a small change in this area can be a big change down the line. And there is this administrative aspect that you have to deal with. I mean, sometimes these decrees can wind up taking administrative time on the pensions things and explaining to lawyers and figuring it out. So it's all things you think you want to enter into your calculus as you decide how to legislate.
Any other questions? Ms. Vanek, did you have something to add to?
Mr. Chair and members, again, Mary Vanek, PARA. Senate File 45 was the Senate file that Senator Gutzel introduced on behalf of PBRA. First, I'd like to clarify one point. The 87 law that governs the dissolution process is working, and all three statewide funds have people who work with attorneys every single day. We have hundreds of marriage dissolutions on record with PERA for people who are not yet retired. It is once they retire that there is a problem. And that's what Senate File 45 is intended to address. And I know that Mr. Barrick has been working on cleaning it up for us. But what we want to do is to allow those individuals who, if the judge agrees through the court decree that the individual could unwind the joint and survivor option that was chosen and allow the member to bounce back to the single life, not choose another person to designate as a joint and survivor option, but allow the individual member to bounce back to the single life payment and no longer have the obligation of that person who was designated as joint survivor. But it has to be agreed upon through the parties, through the court process, and that's what we would like to see happen. And there should be no actuarial cost, because our pension plans already provide for an automatic bounce back if the joint annuitant dies before the member. So if that happens, if the joint annuitant dies, the member bounces back to the single life payment. So this is just, you know, in the case of a divorce after the persons are retired and the court distributes the properties such that the pension is no longer part of the equation, the member can bounce back to the single life but not name another individual.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Vanek, tell me a circumstance why somebody would want to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, in the mid-90s, you had the Pension Commission had a bill before it. Two individuals married to one another, both PERA members, both had chosen options. They retired. The marriage did not work out beyond retirement. Sometimes that happens. And both individuals wanted to return to their single life options, or single life payments, and no longer continue to have that obligation for one another. I have a disabilitant who has been communicating to me annually since I became director, whose marriage dissolution decree directs that she has agreed to give up her joint and survivor option, but because he's already receiving benefits, our laws don't allow for that. So it was in the distribution of the property between the parties, the courts decreed that the pension would not be part of the value awarded to the ex-spouse. But we can't accommodate that because of the law.
Okay. Any other questions, Ms. Fanning? Thank you. Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on this topic? Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Scott Vettelson. I'm from Akeley, Minnesota, and I am what your question is. I'm very nervous. This is new to me, so and please thank you for all being here. Mm-hmm. May 31st, 2007, I was divorced. 6 months later, after I could no longer change my joint, I had it as 100% survivorship for my then wife. 6 months later, I retired, or she divorced me. I could not change it. Our agreement in our divorce decree was she gets hers, I get mine. She is also a TRA person, teacher, and we agreed to have each our own. I am the person that wants to go back and have do the bounce back with zero survivorship. Senator Betzold, I disagree with you. It will not cost more for the pension fund because the actuarial was based on the survivorship, was on me. And that amount of money is already set. If I go back to the joint survivor, or the no beneficiary, it costs no more. Me doing that is actually going to save the state money. Actuarials prove that women will live longer than men. My ex-wife's parents are in their mid to upper 80s. Her grandmother lived to 90. I die, she lives till 85, 90. The state keeps paying pension to her, even though I'm dead, based on my 100% survivorship. That is going to cost the state more money rather than less. If I go to the joint back to the bounce back, it ends. And it will be no more than what it was set on my amount. So I disagree. And I hope for others beside myself, I have two friends that when they're teaching the same time as I did, went through the same thing that I'm going through right now. And they're in the same situation. Their decrees were just like mine. What's mine is mine, what's hers is hers. But I can't change it. And to me, a divorce is like a death. We don't like revisiting death. Every month that I get my retirement, I visit that death. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Reverend Murphy. Sir, come on back. I got a question for you.
Just for clarification. You're a teacher?
Yes.
Your former wife is the teacher?
Yes.
She has her retirement?
Yes.
You have your retirement?
Yes.
Do you selected?
I selected 100% survivorship for her. She did not retire until a year later. May 31st. It was done in March or April of 2007.
When you selected, you were married?
Yes.
And you selected 100% for her?
Yes.
From your retirement?
From my retirement.
So where does the what's mine is mine and what's hers is hers come in?
When the divorce decree was done, by the way, I did not hire a lawyer for the divorce.
Well,
so I didn't have that. So I didn't get the benefits from the lawyer. We didn't do that because we agreed it was over. But in the decree, we agreed in the decree that my pension is mine. She relinquishes all rights to it. And I did the same for her. That's where what's mine is mine and what's hers is hers comes from. Do you understand what I'm saying? We have two people retired. Two people that are TRA members.
So in your divorce decree, you went back, you thought you could go back and
correct.
Change what your retirement selection had been.
Yes.
You made that decision without contacting the
TRA? No, I contacted TRA. And TRA says it can't be done. I've contacted TRA many, many times. And each time I have, they always respond, you have to go to the legislature to get the law changed. And I have sent numerous, numerous emails on this.
Apparently he's got a divorce decree that says what's his is his and what's his wife is his. But that isn't the way TRA sees it. They say no way.
Made that decision
correct.
Back.
Right.
Yes.
Way back.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. When you made the decision at your time of your divorce, what's yours is yours and hers is hers, did you contact TRA at that time?
Yes.
But they said no, you could
they
not
said
do
no,
that.
Because the time is 60 days past the day you get your first benefits. I might be exact wrong on that, but I think that's correct. 60 days after the first benefit.
Right.
Well, there was no problem with any part of the divorce
until
5 months later.
So what happened is exactly what Ms. Vanek just testified to.
That is correct.
It works fine until the retirement takes place and you want to bounce back.
That's
I have a clue.
That's why I said I'm the exact thing that she just talked about.
Okay.
Thank
gotcha.
You.
Okay. Any other questions? Sir Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, just to make sure that I'm understanding what you're saying, I think what you're saying is because, let's say, a person's spouse had died and they would be allowed to have the right to this bounce back because it doesn't actuarially make any difference to the fund, that your situation ought to be viewed the same way because it isn't going to make an actuarial difference?
Yes.
I mean, sometimes we have people who come, and I just would like to hear from someone who can confirm that one way or another if that's the case or not. Because we do have situations sometimes where people come and they've been taking a higher amount based on a single life. And then a person dies sooner than was expected, and that's why we made the recent change in the law a couple of years ago to make sure that the other spouse knew that that was going to be the situation, because we can't actuarially allow someone to take the higher amount and then still get the survivorship benefit, because that would impact everyone else in the fund if you could have it both ways, you know. And so that's why we have to try to be fair to everyone. So I think I understand what you're saying is that you don't believe this is the situation or that there would be any harm to the fund or either party harmed if this is what they've agreed. And I just wondered if, you know, we could have that confirmed if that is the case.
That was my comment that when I said that if my ex-wife was to die, I could then go back and change it. So now when I look at it, that's where it came from. But
thank
yes.
You.
Any other questions of this witness? Is there anybody else?
I had a question.
I'm sorry, Representative Olson.
And so the way I understand this, Mr. Chairman, is that right now the way it's set up, if you were to pass away before your ex-wife, she would actually get a cash benefit
because she would get
50% for life.
She gets 100%.
Or 100%
for
so
her life.
She would end up getting your pension on top of her pension.
That is correct.
And so she'd be double dipping in the pension and would actually cost the pension fund more money.
That is correct.
And how does it work with hers? I mean, do you get any benefit out of her pension?
I do not. Okay. I do not the way I had it. We set it up together. I have made no claim when she retired, because she retired a year later than myself.
After the divorce.
Okay. After the divorce.
Okay.
It was about actually a year. It was 6 months after the divorce that she retired.
Interesting time. Okay. Anything else? Any questions?
To use this point, the way it's supposed to work is that before the parties divorce and decide what they're going to do and they arrange a property settlement, the value of every marital property item is supposed to be determined and then allocated in a way that's fair. The fact that this gentleman had elected a JNS for his spouse should have been taken into account. That should have, an amount should have ended up on her side of the ledger when they were squaring things up. And presumably with competent counsel, that would have occurred.
But that was not the way it was done. It was done in this fact that what was hers and mine. We both taught approximately the same amount of time in the public schools in the state of Minnesota. So that was not the case. That dollar amount for mine and that dollar amount for her was never took an equitable amount. It was just, you take yours, I take mine.
Yeah, but again, the deal that you and your wife reached, TRA was not a party to that, and there may have been other ways to have addressed this, but as I say, I mean, you... Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Pappas?
Why would it be if, you know, people have their own pension rights, like you're... Right. Why would you even have a survivor annuity if people have their own pension rights? Isn't that kind of a double-dipping situation?
Well, Senator, I'm not sure it's a double-dipping, but there's economically, one could argue or ask the question why. It would have been very improbable that it would have made sense that both parties would have taken joint and survivors.
Mm-hmm.
They each can't survive the other. Somebody's going to die first, and they're both going to die at the same time, but they can't outlive each other. So it's an insurance that you're buying that doesn't
but
make
it doesn't seem to make
sense
to Mr. Chairman to even purchase that insurance if you have your own capability to have your own
both
pension.
Both of them have it, yeah.
From the same pension fund.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it if you're coming from a different pension fund, that might be an option.
If that happens, would it?
Mr. Brunson.
I am getting less on my pension.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I took part of my pension that I could have received, and that was waylaid into another account for her to get on my death.
But why? My question is why?
Why? Because actuarially, I'm a mathematical instructor. She's going to live longer than I am. Would your husband want us to provide for you if it was possible? Because he's going to divide before you, die before you? That's what I did. It was for her.
Mr. Chairman, let me understand. So if she retires, she gets her own pension.
That is correct.
She also gets the
part of
yours.
That is correct. And that is what I'm hoping to change. We've already agreed to it together. But the legislature is standing in the way.
Okay, anything further? Okay, does anybody else want to be heard on this particular topic? If not, we've... Mr. Kepler, did you want to speak? Come on forward. Identify yourself for the record.
Members of Phil Kepler, St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. I really don't have a whole lot on this particular topic. The only advice I would offer the commission is if you're dealing with special legislation and particular individuals, and sometimes you end up doing that, or dealing with legislation that affects one fund or one plan, it's a different matter than making general law in this area. We have the general law now on the 50% default joint survivor option without notification. I would just encourage you to sort of decide up front whether you're going to be making policy in this area based on a survey of particular circumstances or issues that have come before you, or go back to attempted to make policy on broader principles reflecting back on the purposes for the plan. Notions of reliance and relationship between members and survivors and designated beneficiaries more generally. I think that there's a lot of hazard in this area if the strength of a particular case or the circumstances of a particular case end up having too much sway over general policy. That's just my general concern.
Well, as you know, the commission is somewhat unique, and the pensions area is somewhat unique because we do have bills that, you know, are drawn that ultimately apply to only one person or, you know, one very narrow set of individuals. And we do try to avoid passing broad policies based upon a single instance. So we try to be careful in those areas.
All I would say is the hazard I see there. Divorces are something this time of year I'm particularly sensitive to, because with teachers who have sort of been able to maintain a ceasefire over the course of 9 or 10 months during the school year, they're kind of thrown back into the ring together over the summer, and we see a spike in St. Paul in August, and they all end up on my desk. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else on this topic? I think we've reached a breaking point here. Why don't we adjourn recess here for about 20 minutes? Give everybody a chance to move around, get a quick bite to eat, you know, do whatever you wish to, stretch your legs, talk to the pension fund directors. Just quickly, members, this got a little more complicated than what I thought, but the per diem issue. The Senate members submit your forms, we'll collect them, and those will be submitted to the Senate for their payment. The House will pay for the House per diem. I think the transportation costs may be charged to pension commission, I guess. Yeah, but the transportation is just mileage and so forth. But anyway, this got a little bit more complicated than I hoped it was going to be. Also, I have run into a problem. I try to set the schedule out in April, okay? I tried to set the schedule in April so everybody would know what's going to happen, and my own caucus has decided they're going to have their golf tournament on September 9th. So, we're not going to make a decision today, but we're going to see if you might be available the day before, the day after, whatever. But I need to figure out what the members want to do. But let's take a recess for about 20 minutes, and then we'll be back.
Get the sound fixed.
Okay, start it up. Okay, good afternoon. We resume the meeting of the Legislative Commission of Pensions Retirement for Wednesday, August 12, 2009. I've been told that the air conditioning is out and that the part is going to arrive tomorrow, which doesn't do us any good, but that's the situation we've got. Okay, we've got the next item on our agenda is number four, general consideration of the definition of a surviving spouse of a public pension plan survivor benefits. And this is Mr. Martin's memo. Mr. Martin.
Members, this is an August 3rd memo. It should be second from the last item in your packets. It's general consideration of the definition of surviving spouse for public pension plan survivor benefits. The memo is somewhat lengthy because survivor benefits are a little bit complicated in our systems, in part because some of our plans are covered by Social Security and some of our plans do not incorporate Social Security coverage, and the survivor benefit operates differently depending upon whether or not Social Security is part of the overall plan coverage. The first part of the memo just simply talks about survivor coverage as part of the somewhat adjunct benefits of a public pension plan. Public pension plans, although they didn't necessarily start off this way, now exist as a retirement insurance. It's a benefit that's paid upon a person retiring. And it's been extended to cover extra factors, casualty circumstances like disability or pre-retirement death, and that's when the definition of survivor pops up. Just to give you a sense, the various pension plan actuarial valuation reports do break out the value of the various pension benefits that are provided by a plan. The age and service benefit is our normal our retirement benefit. You look on the bottom of page one, the table there. And that's the bulk of the cost of a public employee pension plan. And then disability, survivor benefit coverage, deferred retirement benefits, and refunds make out comprise the balance of the things that are identified as separate cost factors. And you get a flavor there that the survivor benefit coverage is somewhat of a caboose on a long train. It's not a terribly expensive part of the program. I do differentiate, if you flip to page 2, on types of survivor benefit coverage. Pre-retirement survivorship coverage is frequently different than post-retirement survivorship coverage. Pre-retirement is more a question of a casualty item. It's the attempt by the pension plan to cover an exceptional circumstance. Post-retirement survivorship coverage in most of our plans tends to be handled by joint and survivor coverage. It's elective in insurance. And most survivorship coverage is also provided in our plans by Social Security. In the bottom of page 2, I start talking about what we refer to as status survivor benefits and non-status survivor benefits. In police and fire plans, those plans that don't have Social Security coverage, and for pre-retirement survivor benefits, survivor benefits are frequently paid for by virtue of having the status of being a survivor. And that's when the definition of surviving spouse that the commission has been troubled about periodically tends to pop up. Does somebody have the status of being the survivor of a public pension plan member who's died? We lay out on page 3 in the top of page 4 how the survivor benefit coverage, pre-retirement and post-retirement, is set forth. And again, making essentially the point, when you see automatic survivor benefit coverage, that's a status benefit. An individual who has the status of being a survivor gets a benefit. An elective proposition and is general, frequently not provided to any great extent by the public employee pension plan. Pages 4, 5, and 6 get into a discussion of survivor benefit coverage provided by Social Security. I won't spend any particular time on that other than to make two points. On page 4, there's a table that gives you when the various Minnesota public pension plans added Social Security as part of the total benefit package. And you can see that the dates differ, that it happened over there was a big swell initially in the late 50s, and then parsing out or a less frequent occurrence of adding Social Security coverage thereafter. One of the things that happened in 1957, and this was essentially the work of the first Public Employee Pension Commission that was set up by the 1955 legislature, was the coordination with Social Security and deferring a lot of the cost of the prior pension programs that came out of disability and survivorship coverage to Social Security. The addition of Social Security in 1957, something recommended by the 1955 Pension Commission, did have a practical impact of reducing the costs of the resulting pension plans considerably, because a lot of the casualty benefit coverage was shifted over to Social Security. On page 6, we do lay out the various definitions that exist in a statute for surviving spouse. And in the instance where there's no specific definition, spouse would have the commonly understood definition of spouse, meaning someone who's legally married to the pension plan member, the dictionary definition of a spouse. In other instances, there are differing definitions, and sometimes a question of time duration becomes important. This is when this typically occurs in our non-Social Security benefit plans, the plans that are not covered or not incorporating Social Security coverage as part of the benefit coverage, where either the death occurs not in the line of duty, where it's a death that occurs outside of normal employment, or where the survivor only obtains that status after the retirement of the pension plan member. So a retiree who marries late in life or has a second marriage after the person chooses to retire, there may be a duration requirement. And some of our more difficult instances in getting one person or small group bills has been when a survivor has been married for almost the required period of time, but not quite. So, members, this is to try and put the question of the definition of a surviving spouse for pension plan benefits into some context, and to give you a comparison of the differing definitions of surviving spouse. Whether you want to, it's not. These tend to pop up as special bills periodically. There's one that was heard last year on a repeat basis from a few years prior to that, the Mrs. S.B. Griffin issue. It's not clear when these might pop up in the future, but this may help set or give you a better sense of how surviving spouse definitions play out in our plan coverage.
Just to put it in context, I think you mentioned the fact that we require a certain time period of the marriage before we, in statute, recognize it, and that's, as I recall, the justification was that to avoid the sham marriages, so that somebody would get married quickly to take advantage of some pension benefits, which sometimes are sham and sometimes are not. But at least that was the guiding principle. Let's see, Representative Murphy, you had some.
Does any of the plans have the surviving spouse having to have been the spouse during the time that the person worked? Or can under all the plans, the surviving spouse be somebody that just came in after they were retired?
In looking just quickly at page 7 and focusing on TLA, their definition of surviving spouse is someone who was married to the member at the time of death. I guess that's not necessarily ever before. Yeah. But the first class city teachers I'm looking at retirement at death is not the issue.
That one instance that we found, that we heard several times, but it was only the last time we heard it, that we heard that the marriage took place after the retirement, rather than during the time.
It used to be the custom in the local police and paid fire plans that a person only was a surviving spouse if they were married to the police officer or firefighter prior to the police officer or firefighter retiring from active service. And that changed over the years. It started probably in the 1980s, that the start of that change, where there was more authority or there, if permission was granted to extend the definition to post-retirement marriages. And typically with a time period, and the time period did two things. One, it avoided sham marriages. The other is it reduced the actuarial cost, as the way any vesting period reduces the actuarial cost. Some individuals will not get the coverage, and as a consequence, it would be less costly.
Mr. Rice?
Just a quick question. Brian Rice, Minneapolis Police and Fire, to Representative Murphy's point. The reason in the police and fire it's so important about the length of marriages is that if you are married, there's an automatic survivor benefit, and you don't pay for it. If you're married, you get it. If you don't get it, you don't. So on an actuarial basis, being married is more valuable than not being married, as opposed with the other defined benefit plans, you just accrue a benefit, and then you get so much, and you can decide how to spend it. So with the police plan, and it's actually a feature the legislator's old plan has, if you're married, you get more. If you're single, there's this benefit you could add to the liability of the plan if you're simply married. And that's why there is this, that Senator Betz had talked about the deathbed provision. If you just got married in the last day of your life and you could pass, you could increase the cost of the plan. And so with the Relief Association plans and the legislative plan, I shouldn't speak about the legislative plan. With the Relief Association plan, there was some need to prevent the sham marriages. Whereas with the other plans, at least my understanding is that you get the benefit at this amount, and then it doesn't increase because you're married or not.
Thank you for that clarification. I didn't know that.
Well, you did. You just forgot.
Yeah. Do we have any particular, this is just kind of a broad-based memo to kind of remind us, but do we have any specific instances coming up other than people are looking for exceptions on the length of marriage requirements or how to define what the marriage was or anything like that?
Members, there's nothing in the current set of bills that are left over from the 2009 session that seem to deal with this topic, other than the S.P. Griffin bill that we did deal with during 2009.
And that was the common law marriage one?
That was the individual who married a retired Minneapolis firefighter, and they were married slightly less than the minimum period.
Right.
I forget what the minimum period was 2 years or 18 months, but they were about 2 months shy, some fraction of 2 months shy of the minimum period.
The argument was they had lived together.
Right, the common law marriage. They've been together, raised kids, and then they got married, but didn't live long enough to treat it. So these issues do come up on a peaceful basis. So, okay.
Mr. Chair, didn't we also have the situation with the St. Louis Park police officer who was killed over in Iraq?
Yeah, that had a couple of issues going on there because and actually that wasn't in the pension bill. That was put in I think the ag bill, as I recall. But
but when he was a houseman.
Yeah. Yeah. And Senator Kelly.
Steve Kelly.
Dallas Hamp had a hand in that, too. No, what happened there, and that was done mainly in the argument to pass the bill, was because we're going to close the state parks because of the partial government shutdown. We had to pass that bill, and they snuck it in at the last minute. But it defined this individual. It was a tragic situation. He died as a he was a police officer from St. Louis Park, and he was deployed. And it defined him as being a police officer at the time of his death, which created a problem because he also was a soldier at the time of his death. So he got death benefits from the federal government for being a soldier, and he also died as a police officer in the line of duty, just as though he died on the streets of St. Louis Park. And that was probably bad policy, especially considering how many people are being deployed, and that situation could come up over and over.
Mr. Chairman, his wife hadn't been married that long. It had been a fairly short marriage.
But the big issue was the argument was made to the pension commission was not so much the length of marriage, but to define him as dying in the line of duty as a police officer, and the pension commission rejected it. But as they say, a completely different conference committee accepted the argument and passed it, and we have since repealed that provision. No, I mean, it still applies. I mean,
that person,
Amy Day still gets the benefits. I mean, but we changed it for future situations. So we do not define people as, you know, dying in two different statuses for death benefit purposes. So, okay, anything else on this issue? Anybody from the public who wants to be heard on this particular topic? As I say, this is a general issue that we've been kind of looking at. And we may have some more discussions as the issues come up later on, but we want to refresh ourselves. So if not, we will go to the fifth item on the agenda, which is a study that we have been looking at for a while. This actually came up for a proposal during the 2009 legislative session from the House, and it came out, frankly, from the discussions about the funding of MRF, but we want to have a broader discussion of creating a pension fund consolidation assistance fund. And so we started at the last meeting with sort of looking at the topic. This is the second time we're going to be looking at it, and we're going to look at it at least probably two more times before we really take any action on it. But we want to start thinking in the direction we want to go in. So I certainly the MRF employees would have an interest in it, as well as, frankly, other pension fund members. Mr. Mark.
Members, yes, this is the larger memo that's in your packets, and the approach I've taken in putting together materials for you with this is the proposal, in the broadest sense, is a consolidation assistance fund creation. And so the first memo looked at consolidation as a topic. This is looking at the funding aspect of the topic. What is the past experience of the Minnesota legislature in creating funds for specialized pension purposes. In the future, we will be taking a look at what other states have done of a similar nature to the extent that anyone has to see if there's any insight that we can derive from other state experiences. We also will be looking at which pension plans may be in the need of some assistance from their actuarial work when we get the later fall actuarial work, and then we will explore the options that might be available to you to try and marry these providing assistance to consolidations through additional resources. The first part of this memo, pages up through the middle of page 4, is really the summary of the first memo, which I did verbally for you the last meeting, and I did indicate that I would reduce it to writing. And this is essentially the presentation from last time on the consolidation portion of the topic, looking as to why it would appear that we that the legislature has done various consolidations, what seem to be the motivating factor or factors, and also looking at how we handle funding considerations in past consolidations. The meat of this memo starts really on page 4. I would draw you first to the bottom of page 4. The state of Minnesota has created 16 different programs that are specific funding of public employee pensions or something very comparable to public employee pensions in the case of the Ambulance Service Longevity Award and Incentive Program. I put these together in chronological order based on when they were created, not topically. So Fire Aid is the oldest, and the various 1997 aid programs are the youngest, were created most recently. You flip quickly to page 5. I'm not going to go through these in detail, but I will lay out for you how I framed out the information that I provided. For each of the aid programs, the first topic will give you how it was established, what was the legislation, and if there was a clear motivating factor, why it seemed to exist, why it was created, best that we can tell. The second item is the source of the revenue that's used in the aid program, and so how it was funded. Is it a dedicated tax receipt? Is it funding that's unused from some other aid program or whatever. Flipping to the bottom of page 7, in the case of fire state aid, the third item that we raise for each of the state aid programs is qualification requirements. What does the entity that gets the aid have to do to get the aid? We lay that out for you. Flipping to page 8 for fire state aid, how is it allocated? How is the money paid out to qualified recipient pension funds? And then final item on page 9, it's labeled here item B, but it's actually item E. What is the permissible use of the state aid? So that you hopefully get the full sense of when did it occur, what money is being given away, who gets it, how do we figure out what they get and what can they do with it when they get it, is the theory. And that's how all of these are structured. Because there are 16 of these programs, this tends to be a long memo. And if you want to draw attention to any particular aid, I will go through it in more detail. But probably to save time and to be the most effective use of our time, if you flip to page 35, I've got some comments, some observations after having done this, some observations about what general lessons seem to pop out from doing the looking at this topic. Of the 16 aid programs, they cover a long period of time. If you go from the creation of fire state aid back in the 1870s up until now, but most of those programs have occurred since 1971, all but three. So 13 out of the 16 have occurred since 1971, and the bulk of the programs occurred during the 1980s and 1990s. No additional aid programs have been created in the past 12 years. There seem to be some motivating factors that seem to have driven the aid program. And I've identified those on page 36 with us. Some examples. General support of a given level of public employment, not necessarily dedicated or not originally dedicated to public pension programs, And that would be the Fire State Aid Program, which initially was there to provide a relief to disabled firefighters and survivors, and also to be a general support of firefighting. It could be used for firefighting equipment, firefighting buildings, or firefighter or survivor relief. The second broad topic, it seems to be the only case where this an aid program started off not being specifically dedicated for public pension purposes and has become wholly a public pension program. The second motivating motivating event seems to be for the purpose of addressing financial difficulties or funding difficulties. And there are a number of those, including a special surcharge for the Duluth, Minneapolis, and St. Paul Fire Department pension plans back when they were pay-as-you-go in 1978 when some significant state funding was first accorded specifically to MRF, and then a number of instances with the creation of amortization aid to help the local police and paid fire plans, and then the first-class city teacher plans getting some additional funding during the middle portion of the 1990s. In some cases, the aid program exists because there's been a traditional obligation for the state in funding our retirement programs. And our basic teacher pension fund aid is that the teacher TRA and its predecessor were initially paid for out of the state general fund directly. It once was part of a statewide property tax levy. Not many folks probably recall state property tax levies, but there once was a general levy imposed by the state on all property, and that was where teacher pension funds were paid for. With the advent of the 67 sales tax, teacher funding grew, and but again, it was a direct funding obligation that was ultimately replaced by some categorical aids that were adjuncts to the general education aid program, and then eventually rolled in or folded into the general education aid program, so that it's not a discernible portion of the general state aid anymore. In some cases, aid was set up to offset legislated benefit increases. One of the examples would be that in 1979, there was a supplemental benefit that was created for volunteer firefighters receiving lump sum benefits. The state legislature changed the way we taxed lump sum benefits that year and created this special supplemental benefit to reduce the impact of that tax law change, and provided that the state would reimburse the various volunteer fire pension funds the cost of that supplemental benefit when they paid it. In 1997, both for the various first-class city teacher plans and for PERA, there was some aid programs set up to fund some or all of the cost of the 1997 benefit improvements. Tax relief seems to be a factor in creating some of the aids. Probably the principal example would be the creation of police state aid in 1971. The motivation was very much to attempt to reduce the property tax levies that were growing in those towns that had local police pension plans. As of 1969, something that the Pension Commission had recommended was the shift from pay-as-you-go funding to full actuarial funding for the local police and pay fire plans. The fire service always had virtually always had a state aid program, and the police officers in the local police pension fund towns pursued the creation of a separate plan for a separate aid program for police pensions. 80% of that initial 1971 police state aid program went to towns with local relief associations. There was a 20% payment to PERA for the balance of the state. That's shifted over time. A sixth reason or purpose would be to duplicate or to approximate the effect of other aid programs. The 1971 police state aid program stands for that. It was trying to replicate for police officers what was already existent for firefighters. And in 1993, when we created the ambulance personnel state aid program and provided aid to it, that was also an attempt to create for ambulance personnel something comparable to what was in line for volunteer firefighters. Distribution problems within an existing aid program is also another motivating factor. In 1996, the minimum volunteer fire state aid program was created. There was a large disparity in the amount of money received in the volunteer fire community because the long-standing manner for distributing fire state aid is a geographical factor based program. It's property value and population, not pension cost. And so places with relatively high property value or relatively large populations or both receive the largest amount of aid irrespective of how many firefighters they need to provide firefighting services. Small jurisdictions with modest populations, modest property value tend to get very modest amounts of fire state aid. So the 1996 minimum aid program was set up to bring every one of the small volunteer fire communities up to a certain level, a few hundred dollars per firefighter to redress some of the distribution problems that seem to exist in the fire state aid program. And the last motivating factor that I could identify is to recapture other pension related aid. The 96 amortization state aid, the additional amortization state aid, is 1997 additional amortization state aid stands for this proposition. Also, the inclusion of some of the teacher pension funds into the amortization and supplemental amortization state aid programs is strictly there to make sure that some pension aid that had run its purpose out, that where the distribution of aid was going down in the dollar amount, was not lost to the pension system at large. And so another use of pension aid was found for an aid program, and it intertwines some of the aid programs. The next point I discuss is on the bottom of page 37, the relationship between aid programs and pension costs or pension liabilities. Six of the 16 aid programs are limited to the amount of the employer pension cost or the amount of the pension benefit disbursement. They didn't all necessarily start that way, but that's what ultimately occurred. Police state aid was not tied to any pension cost, for instance, when it was set up in 1971. But as it changed in the later 1970s, it became a program that reimbursed employee units for their employer police pension cost, and there then was created excess police state aid, which has been used to fund other programs. Similarly, the volunteer fire supplemental benefit reimbursement is set at the amount of the supplemental benefits, not to exceed a certain dollar amount. six of the 16 aid programs are not payable if the applicable pension plan doesn't have an unfunded accrued liability. These tend to be the first-class city teacher aid programs or the local police and paid fire plans. That it's payable if there's an unfunded. If there's not an unfunded, the aid either is done away with for that our recipient, or is done away with for as long as the unfunded accrued liability is not present. And then four of the aid programs pay state aid irrespective of pension plan costs or liabilities. Fire state aid is payable irrespective of pension cost. The minimum fire state aid is also payable up to a floor level amount, and it doesn't really factor in what the actual cost of any particular volunteer fire pension plan is. The ambulance service program aid is also a defined contribution type pension plan, and it's not a set cost, but it is whatever the are the available resources dedicated to that plan would be. The last part of this is some other observations. It's a little hard to figure out sometimes when you're dealing with aid programs that go back to the 1870s to know exactly why a state aid was created. So some of this is guess and surmise on my part. A more practical problem with the legislative practice of not putting in purpose clauses or not indicating always a clear reason for a program is that the subsequent legislators are at a disadvantage when considering alterations in the programs and whether the alteration matches well with the original purpose. Not to pick on this particular commission, but 2009 would be an example of that. You made a change in the amortization aid program, allowing it to be paid to local police or paid fire plans that newly get an unfunded accrued liability. They lost eligibility for the aid when they were fully funded, and that did not, it was not restored. Back in 1980, when the amortization aid program was created, it was to address the fact that the legislature was newly mandating these plans amortize their unfunded accrued liabilities and was paying the differential between what the city owed prior to that amortization requirement being put in place and what it cost to pay the full amortization. So we were paying a small portion of the total contribution on a set amount of, on a certain dollar amount of unfunded liability. When a plan was no longer had an unfunded, the rationale for paying for a mandate, paying the cost of a legislative mandate, no longer applied. When you, in 2009, reinstated eligibility for municipalities that became, once were fully funded and are now less than fully funded, presumably for some reason other than a legislative mandate, that's not necessarily consistent with that 1980 purpose. We, because I was on the commission staff in 1980 when the program was developed, have some understanding of what the motivation was, but there's nothing that I can point to in statute that tells you what your motivation was in 1980, and it makes it harder to know whether you're doing something, you're making a change wholly consistent with that original purpose. Second observation on the bottom of page 38, it's an internal item to the legislature. Things land in various budget compartments, and most of the pension aid programs have now landed in the budget for the tax committee. It's not in the State Department's division budget anymore in total as it used to be. Fire aid, police aid, several of the other police and fire-related items are now in the tax committee budget. And the tax committee has the jurisdiction then for those aid programs. They have little or no understanding of why these aid programs were created. And while they have not made changes or very many changes to those aid programs, we are seeing from an institutional standpoint a disconnect between the expertise over the programs and the legislative entity that's charged with fashioning the changes in those legislative programs. Item three is the intertwining of pension state aids. I'm not sure how many members were here. Several years ago in the mid-1990s, I tried to do a flow chart of the various aid programs to show how they worked, and it got to be a very complex spider web. Subsequent to that, we've done more intertwining since 1996-97, and it's presumably even more intertwined now. The Department of Revenue made an attempt to do a similar flow chart, but they had a few errors in it, and they haven't sent me their new revised version yet. If we ever get one, we'll pass it on to you. But there is an intertwining of these aid programs. The reason why they're intertwined is to keep these aid amounts dedicated for pensions, which presumably is an admirable policy reason. But by tying amounts in one aid program to fund a different aid program does make them very difficult to oversee and to fully understand. Fourth item is if you exclude out the teacher pension aid amounts, which have been folded into the general education aid in large measure, the largest aid programs are dedications of proceeds of a tax rather than being based on a measure of pension funding need. While they are pension aids, they tend to be, this is really the fire and police state aid programs, they are dedications of a portion or most of or even more than the premium tax that's paid on certain types of insurance premiums, fire insurance premiums or auto casualty insurance premiums. They go up or they go down based on the trends in the insurance world, and they provide more or less aid based on that revenue rather than on pension factors. So it's an odd. If the aid amounts were nominal, it wouldn't matter. If it was a drop in a bigger bucket, it wouldn't make so much difference. When police and fire state aids have gotten very, very large, it makes more of a difference. Before the recent increases in the PERA police and fire employer contribution rates, for virtually the entire state, police state aid was greater than employer pension costs in virtually every jurisdiction. That virtually every jurisdiction generated excess police state aid. When you have an aid program that more than covers the total cost of all police pensions, maybe it's not the right way to run an aid program. Then the last item, with the exception of teacher aids and the MRF state aid and the PERA 1987 aid program, most of our pension aids are related to public safety personnel, police, fire, and ambulance pensions. Although public safety personnel make up about 9% of the active membership of Minnesota public pension plans. Now, this is not necessarily favoritism for police and fire in some pure sense. They were historically where the local pension funds were. They were the plans that were in the worst actuarial shape historically. So the need did generate the aid. But it is disproportionate if you look at it. Most of the aid programs and most of the aid goes to a subgroup of the total active public employee membership. So that, members, that covers what I wanted to tell you about this memo. I'll be happy to answer questions about any of the particular aid programs or the conclusions.
Well, and the reason why we're looking at these issues is because when a pension fund gets in trouble, the last thing we want to do is to have it fail, because obviously it impacts a lot of people's lives, and you know, pension issues are probably some of the more important promises that we can make. I think what's spurring this on is the fact that there's one pension fund, MRF, which is has some problems, and we need to address it. Finding out where the money's going to come from to bail them out, to help them out, is the problem here, and this is what the memo and future discussions are going to address. The obviously, if the state had its own, had resources to bail them out, I think that, you know, that's something we could talk about, but the state doesn't. You know, we don't have the state doesn't have the funds. In Murph's situation, it happened. It started as basically a local fund for the city of Minneapolis. It's closed now, so there's no new members in it for a number of years. But the city of Minneapolis doesn't have the money, especially with their local government aid being cut. At the last pension commission meeting, a gentleman that came to us when we were at the Capitol, and he handed me a letter. He was a retiree from Murph, and he had a bunch of ideas to solve the problem, and of course he wanted a surcharge on insurance policies throughout the state, which I don't think would have been well received by legislators outside of Minneapolis, or conversely a surcharge on water fees throughout the state, which I don't think would have been well received. Obviously, if the city of Minneapolis wanted to impose that, well, you don't need the legislature to do that. The city could do that. So where the money comes from becomes problematic. Now, we're just having a handout here. What does this say, Mr.
Yes,
Martin?
Yeah, members, this is from the Pension Commission staff, and I apologize for not putting that down in the bottom corner, telling you the source. What we've done is taken, with the exception of the teacher pension contribution money, this is the all the dollar amounts that are laid out in the August 4th memo, all in one place. So this for the period 1988 through 2008. These are all the various dollar amounts of aid that were distributed, distributed, with the exception of the TRA, first class city teacher base portion of the state education aid. That's not contained here. But this gives you year by year and by aid amount the total aid for this past 20-year period. Which, it's the same dollar amounts that are in the memo, but just putting them all in one place in a single table. And to give you an idea of the sort of dollar amounts that are involved. It does, if you look on the second page and work backwards, you get an idea of how aids get added on periodically. You see some of the older aids are the only ones there in 1988, and then things grow over time as to the dollar amounts. So we thought it might be interesting to look at the same information that's laid out in the August 4th memo, but all in one place and in more of an eye shot piece of work.
Okay, we're going to be, as I say, talking about this at future meetings as well, too, because we, you know, the issue that's confronting us is MRF, but we have to get a better idea, the bigger picture of where the money comes from and how we're going to be able to help some of the funds that are in trouble. Any discussion on what we've heard so far? Any questions? Is anybody... Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two comments on the memo. The first one on page 38, mm-hmm. under other observations, number two, where we're recognizing that in some cases there are perhaps pension issues that are falling under the jurisdiction of another division. And, you know, I'm thinking about, while it wasn't related to a state aid program, we saw some of that this last session with the budget proposal that came forward from the governor's office with regard to corrections. And I was very concerned because that proposal came to the Health Finance Division in the Senate. Very interesting discussion, but I felt also that it was was being discussed in a way that would be reflective of that division, not necessarily reflective of the pension commission. And I would really be interested if there's a mechanism, if there's something we need to do so that as situations, whether it's state aid programs or another budgetary item, as I suspect that there could be perhaps others forthcoming, that I think it's important that this commission, at least if it's going to go to another division, at least that this commission, it go forward with a recommendation from the commission.
Well, and that was a unique situation, as you recall, and again, for the members of the public here. The governor had proposed moving correction employees from the plan that they're in right now into a general plan, mainly because of health care costs, because they were promised health care costs, and they were skyrocketing. So the reason why it was heard in the health budget division was because of the health care costs. But it was a corrections employees issue, so it was also discussed within the corrections budget area. But it was clearly a pension issue because you're moving people from one pension plan to the other. We ultimately did discuss this in the Pensions Commission, and we took a vote not to support the proposal. We haven't done anything further on it, and the proposal died, but that doesn't mean the issue is going away because it's still going to be eating more of the health care budget, and it's going to affect correction employees and so forth. So, it is hard sometimes to track some legislation around here because you're right. I mean, if the tax committee is now getting more and more involved with property tax assistance for pension issues, that isn't anything that we oversee, because our bill normally doesn't go to the tax committee.
Mr. Martin? During the 2009 session, I was asked to come to the House Tax Committee Property Tax Division. They were looking at the state budget. This is back before the full budget proposal had come from the governor. And they were looking at what would happen if we have to reduce our budget by some percentage amount, and looking at the totality of the state budget that was under their control. And the observation was made by several of the members of the House Tax Committee that, well, we know who we hurt in items X, Y, and Z, but all these pension things, we don't know what's going on there. Why don't we just cut them? And that's part of the issue that I'm raising here. It's not just that they may add programs, but they also might reduce programs without fully being cognizant of the effect that they have.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to put this in a little bit of context for me to understand, and we've had this discussion before, but so that we can understand the context of our options versus doing nothing. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone wants to see this situation with MRF develop to the point that, you know, that it would come to something like this, but don't the retirees have some legally enforceable rights in this situation? And if so, against whom would they be enforced, and ultimately, whose responsibility would that be?
Ultimately, I think the city of Minneapolis would be on the hook, I believe.
In the school district,
yeah, because it was their employees. Now, mind you, the retirees live throughout the whole state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So as far as constituents go, they're all of us. But this is a local fund. Ms. Martin?
I've expressed my view previously that I think that these are employer-funded pension funds. The employer is the ultimate guarantor of these benefits, and that's how the case law would ultimately work out. I can't point to any Minnesota cases that have come to that conclusion. We haven't had any plans go defaulting since the 1930s, and in the 1930s, a gratuity theory of pensions was used where the employer gave a pension much like a gold watch and didn't have to keep giving you successive gold watches. Whatever you got as a gift, and if you got another one, that was another gift. So the 1930s case law doesn't apply. Gene Ranieri was here from the city of Minneapolis. He may want to comment. Minneapolis has hired a law firm to explore the issue. And since I don't maintain an active law license, I can't give you any opinion that's particularly better than anyone else in the room. But since the city of Minneapolis is exploring or has explored that issue, you may want to invite whatever they're willing to tell us about what the conclusions are of that work.
Mr. Ranieri, you don't have to comment if you're involved in some issues, but you know, did you want to give us an update on your issue or anything? Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the IGR director for the city of Minneapolis. Mr. Martin is right. We are looking at these issues. We are also working with our folks from MRF to try and find a solution. Representative Thiessen is charged to do things, but I have no comment on the who's liable issue. It's still to be it's being discussed.
Sure. And just in case people don't know, I mean, there was a proposal to have MRF rolled into PERA, the PERA Board of Directors. Was happy to do that if, as long as there was some money going along with it. But if
enough
there was no money,
enough money.
But without the money, they opposed it, and that's where we're at the moment, I believe. So, okay, any Representative Murphy,
which comes to another problem, another issue that if we were to set up this pension fund for future use of people that want to become part, where would the money come from?
That's right, and I think there has to be some nexus between the money. Again, assuming no state aid, and there's not going to be any state aid that we can see. And if it's, I think if you have a statewide fund, it makes it a little easier to maybe find the sources. When we have like a local fund, as MRF is, you know, that makes the challenge more difficult because there's not a lot of money the locals can come up with. So, the options do depend upon what type of situation we're really looking at here, I think so. Sarah Olson?
Well, if we were to set up this kind of a consolidated fund, with the theory, at least from on the parameters of the fund, that it could be used not just for MRF but for other funds in the future, to make it more of a statewide fund, but then the money went, you know, to this particular fund. I mean, how would that be any different than just providing the money directly, unless there was an ongoing funding source that you knew that was going to be there for the next case that might come up?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the difference is that, you know, we have standing appropriations, you know, that usually come in the state government budget bill that, you know, Representative Kahn and I have carried this past session, which just, you know, have been done for years, but... I don't see new standing appropriations coming or even the current ones being increased. And so if we don't use state money to do it, that's where we have to say, well, you know, and I think you're looking at surcharges, you're looking at something else, and, you know, now you're looking at big fights in the legislature to find that kind of money. Senator Lynch?
On the spreadsheet that the Minnesota pension-related state aids that was distributed, were all of the amounts expended, are they all used by each of those funds?
I don't think anybody sends any back.
Martin, or anything? Yes, this is the actual amounts that were received under the program, and things like excess police aid is not included here except to the extent that it funds some other aid program. So this is not just the gross receipts of the auto casualty insurance premium tax that underlies the police state aid. It's the actual police state aid that was allocated in the year indicated.
Senator Mr. Martin, do you think we can get a copy of that graph that finance is trying to do before we talk about this again?
Sure, I would be happy.
That would be helpful.
Yes, we do have the first draft of it. I will put a cover memo on noting what isn't correct about it or where there's an omission, so that you have some ability to flag where it's wrong or incomplete. Yes, I'd be happy to do that and send it out in the interval.
The questions of the members. Is there anybody here who wants to be heard on this particular topic? As I say, this is an ongoing thing we've got some discussions on, but, you know, it is quite complex. But if anybody here wants to weigh in on it, please feel free. We're going to, as I say, when we're done here, I did say we'd leave some time open for general comments or questions of the commission or the funds and so forth. So if it's not directly on this point, we'll be have an opportunity in a few minutes to talk. So is there anybody else on this particular topic here? If not, then we will await the third consideration in the next memo comes forward. As I said, now we normally don't do this, but since we are having our commission meeting at a place away from the Capitol, and the reason why we're coming here today is so that we can hear any issues or concerns or comments from members of the public who normally don't get down to St. Paul. So this is your opportunity, if you want to, just come on forward. If you've got any questions or comments to bring to our attention, please do so. So mic is open. I saw that the three people would sign up in the back had already testified, so I'm assuming that their issues were taken care of. So anybody here who's got wants to bring it, talk to us about anything, it's, we're here. Healthcare, we're not going to talk about. Okay? But pension-related, we're here. Okay? Is there anybody here? Okay. Only one, two, okay.
He's coming.
Okay, come on forward, sir. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Mark Sorensen from Bemidji. Thank you, Senator mm-hmm. Olson, for
Thank
bringing
you for
the commission
coming.
Here. One thing I wanted to talk about was a MSRS general plan. And I'll be talking apples to apples, not apples, oranges. We all have, funds are set up differently. The benefit package is different, and that's apples and oranges. Apples to apples. I do have, if I could,
sure,
pass out.
Yeah.
The best way to illustrate that is to give an example of a. These are two different employees, covered under the same MSRS. General plan, both hired after July 1st of 1989, and the level formula, of course, is being used. Employee one is started work right after college, 22. 40 years of work, retires at 62, and the percentage is whatever. That's what the percentage is at 40 years, using that formula. Employee two starts his public service or her public service at age 31, accumulates 33 years of total service, retires at age 64. That is that person's retirement amount. I think it's a big inequity. The younger person that started at an earlier age has 40 years in, is only earning 3% or so more than the person with 33 years. I think that the level formula, I think, bases it too much on age rather than years of service. So what this goes to, or what, I think the bottom line is the rule of 90 has to start moving forward. I think that's what has to start happening. Rule of 90, anybody hired before, of course, you know that. July 1st, 89, anybody hired after, then follows the level formula. I think it's an inequity. I mean, I think you could see that. Any questions on that?
We asked Mr. Bergstrom to take a look at this too, so I'm not quite sure. But is it your testimony that you believe that employees should have the rule of 90? Is that
it is? Yes.
Okay. I'll offer just my thoughts on it, and I'm sure I'd be interested in having the funds talk about it too. But certainly, I mean, there used to be a rule of 85, rule of 90, and for those who are not familiar with what those concepts are, you take your years of service plus the age at retirement, and if it totaled 90, you got to retire. What wound up happening is that over the years, as more and more actuarial studies were done, it was costing the funds way too much money because people were retiring earlier. I'm 58 years old. Had I gone into public service teaching or got I was in public service. I was an intern at the Ramsey County Attorney's Office when I was going to law school. Had I continued with that, I'd be retired today.
I'd be drawing a pension check today at age 58, and I'd be working a second job right now, as some people who retired under the rule of 90 was done. And pension plans were never intended to let you retire early so you can get that check and start working a second job. Pensions were intended so that you could have, you know, work as long as you could and then get some security when you couldn't work any longer. And so because people were living longer and working fewer, retiring earlier, the funds were getting into huge trouble because of it. And so as a result, and it was quite apparent back in 1989, so that's why the very few of us here were in the legislature in 89, but they got rid of it back then. I don't quite see it returning. And a couple of other trends have gone in the pension area, too. A lot of people retiring under the rule of 90 had a defined benefit plan. Your high five decided, what you're going to get. But there's downsides to that, too, because inflation can eat away with that. If inflation starts going up, your high five doesn't do you any good. And we, on the pension commission, we've had to deal with issues of trying to supplement benefits over the years because the high five wasn't enough to keep up with inflation. Some plans have gone over to defined contribution where you contribute your money and, how the stock market does, and the stock market hasn't been doing very well lately, but that defines what your pension is going to be. So there's upsides and downsides to doing that. My personal view is I don't see that Rule 90 or even something comparable is going to be able to be done because of the hits that the funds were taking, and that's why it was eliminated back in 89. But, I'm sure, Mr. Martin.
A slight correction, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
The Rule of 90 was only applicable to PERA before 1989.
Okay.
PERA had it for about a decade before 1989.
Yeah.
It did not exist in MSRS or in TRA.
The TRA was just done on the Senate floor, the House of the Legislative floor, and made retroactive, right?
Well, it was made applicable to anyone who was in place hired before 1989. So the elimination of the Rule of 90 is true if you're talking about PERA.
Right.
It was newly granted MSRS and the TRA and on its face limited to pre-89 hires.
Right.
So just to the extent that the elimination seems to create a potential sense of right by folks that they had something that they lost in 89. Yeah. They were given a limited benefit in 89.
Yeah, no one ever went into teaching expecting the Rule of 90 because it was just given to the people in 1989, but the PERA had it there.
Right. Yes.
Okay. I would say that it's rather disheartening, I would imagine, and this won't come up for another 20 years because, it's been 20 years since the Rule of 90. Mm-hmm. Anybody hires, after that July 1st. This employee that's got 40 years compared to the employee that has 33 and earning 3 percentage points more. It's going to be a little disheartening to that.
I don't know if you brought this up regarding, this is MSRS, I think, right? I don't know if they or the other funds want to comment on it as well, too. They certainly have the opportunity as long as they're here. Mr. Bergstrom, did you want to talk about it? Or? Did you have any comments? You've seen the handout that he gave here. I've made my comments, but perhaps I'm interested to see the funds. But it's the legislature that sets the policy here. Mr. Bergstrom, Mr. Fernandez, if you step away for a second.
Oh, sorry.
Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System. First, I want to say that this is not just an issue for MSRS General Plan.
Right.
It applies to teachers and PERA. You had that bill last year where TRA tried to address this for TRA members. It is primarily a function of the early retirement penalty. That's what is making the difference because there's an actuarial reduction in benefits. So the reason the person at 62's benefit is lower, even though they worked more years of service, is they're going to collect a pension for two more years. And it really gets down to a function of affordability. As you stated, Senator Betzel, we increased our employee and employer contributions several years ago, phasing in, and there is a cost to that. I think when our next valuations are done, you're going to see the impact of a substantially negative stock market. And it will be pretty apparent that paying for the benefits we have will need to be looked at, let alone adding benefits. So I'm not unsympathetic. I do think that rule of 90 is not the solution if you ever, when you have that cliff, people just fall short of a cliff. If you ever want to adjust the early retirement penalties or lower our age of full retirement from 66 to 65, you can accomplish some of those same issues without going to a rule of 90, where in MSRS, very few people actually ever take advantage of it. Yeah. Our usage rate is fairly low, probably in the area of 15 and 18%, and getting less because of the cost of health insurance.
Yeah. Mr. Bergstrom alluded to an issue that we had in the legislature this past session. TRA was looking at something. They've indicated that they're not really looking at the rule of 90 anymore, but they wanted to find a way that if a teacher had like 30 years of service, and they could retire by age 62 as an example, instead of working until age 66. And but that didn't pass because we couldn't come up with money to do it. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I have looking at this, and that's what hit me, is, and Mr. Bergson's touched on it, the age 62. What would be the difference in the high percentage, the high five, if this other one was 40 years with 64 years of service, or retiring at age 64? I mean, I know there'd be a benefit reduction from 66, but I think that would be more apples to apples.
Yeah, Mr. Bergson.
Oh, Mr. Chair, you're making me do math on the fly here.
It
would probably be in the 56% range, just very quickly off the top of my head. I can probably get you closer if you give me a few minutes. About 60%.
So it'd be about 60%?
Right. Again, quick math.
Yeah. So there is... My point there would be that it is not as close as it would appear that from this.
Mr. Chair, Senator, Representative Nelson, that is the distinction, is that two-year earlier reduction factor. And when you apply an actuarial reduction, each year of an actuarial reduction, the earlier you retire is about roughly a 5% to 6% reduction. So the difference in reduction between 64 and 62 is about a 10% reduction in their monthly. So, okay. And that's really what is driving the difference here.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay. Is there anybody else who wants to bring anything to our attention? Come on forward, sir. Please identify yourself for the record.
Walter Pangburn, MRF member.
Okay. What's your last name again, sir?
Pangburn.
Pangburn. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, this is my first meeting with the pension board. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that I appreciate the care that you're taking. I think that the time that you're taking to do this stuff is important for all of us, and I don't know if you hear that very often. Representative Murphy, you would have won the heart of my wife today by making mention about how long has the partner been involved with the person who worked at the time that they were with their municipality. And I just want to say thanks. I think the care that you take is great. And in my particular case, I hope for a little security assurance in the future that the resolution comes sooner than later, but I appreciate the time that you take.
Yeah, we spent a couple hours, I think in February, on the MRF issue, and I think we're pretty much up to speed on it. It's just, again, finding funding for it, which is what we discussed in the last topic, and we're struggling with it, but... unfortunately, we don't set those kind of policies. We have to look to others to help us figure out where the dollars are coming from. But buck ultimately ends with us. So.
Well, thanks.
So thank you for coming to the hearing. So where are you from? Are you from here, sir?
Merrifield, Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else who wants to be heard today? We're going to, as I say, close it down at 3 o'clock, but or whenever there's no many questions. Okay. Any other comments from anybody in the audience here? Going once. Going twice. I don't see anybody else coming forward. Well, I think we've hit the end of the agenda. Again, we're going to have to contact the members to find out if you might be available the day before or the day after the next scheduled meeting because of a conflict that's come to my attention. I do want to thank Senator Olson again for making the arrangements here and for everybody who did take their time to come forward.
Any last comments, Senator Olson? Anybody else?
Once again, I'd just like to say thank you to the Legislative Commission and to the staff. I know this has been a long trip, a whole day out of your, you know, driving besides the long hours spent here. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate Mr. Pangbird from Mayorfield expressing his thanks. I hope that everyone here who isn't a part of these Legislative Commission meetings regularly has gotten a better feel for the seriousness that the legislature utilizes in dealing with these issues and how important we know they are to you, and that we want to try to make the right responsible decisions for you. So thank you for being here.
And what you saw today is a typical meeting for us. I mean, we spend a lot of time going over details because the final words that go into law are very serious and mean a lot to folks and are going to, you know, impact lives. And I do want to say that when Representative Murphy and Senator Olson say, look, I've got a long trip ahead of me, I want to be done early, so I've got a long, because a long trip in northern Minnesota, I understand. I commend Senator Lynch. She drove up from Rochester. Okay? Wow. She had to get to the Twin Cities and then up to here, so she had a long drive ahead, too. So I thank you for coming here today, and if there's no more business, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.